Beautiful. Good evening. Where's everybody? Huh?
Where
are you? Okay. I would like to open May the 7th, 2014, Prue Vann County Board of Supervisors meeting. Would you join us, please, with the Pledge of Allegiance, followed with a moment of silence? I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Before we... Uh-oh, I've got to cut my phone off. Y'all, forgive me.
Now shut your phone off.
Just don't let it happen again.
Just let it happen again.
That was a very courteous reminder, Mrs. Booker.
And that was that was my son, too. It's all right.
I guess.
I bet he's calling. They don't keep up with my schedule. Okay. All right. That's taken care of. Thank you.
There goes 3 minutes of our lives.
I'm trying to talk to me. I called him.
Just three of us going today?
No. Mr. Sheridan fought a fire today. We had another family to lose their home in West Bottom. You know, we had one in Thessalonia a couple weeks ago. So he will be here, but he's going to be late. And I have not heard from Mr. O'Brien.
Okay, that's what I was wondering. Yeah. Three of us.
Yeah.
That's all right. We can get it done.
Yeah, we can.
Let's take some votes
right
now.
Yeah.
I hope to change the damn budget.
Our attorney is trying to speak to me.
Just for the record, you do have a quorum.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sure.
Yes, thank you.
What else can I think about?
Before we get into our agenda, I'd like to welcome all of you all to the meeting. And I know we have Rear Admiral Burho in the audience, who is the president of Fort Union Military Academy. I think it's the first time you've been?
No,
second time. And we have our new sheriff in the audience, Mr. Hess. And I would like to tell Christina that she did a beautiful job on both stories, for Sheriff Hess' story and for our former Sheriff Washington's story. It was very, very, very well done. And I've seen the former sheriff, and he's doing okay. He's doing all right.
He's sampling a lot.
Yes. And the next thing I'd like to say, the other thing is, we wish all the mothers in the audience a happy Mother's Day this Sunday. And I know that the rest of you will be honoring your mother on Sunday. I have beautiful memories of my mother that I will be thinking about. And if any of the two board members here, if you all want to voice anything concerning talking to our staff or add anything that I've said, or is it sufficient what I've said?
I think it's sufficient.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Now we will have our county administrator's report.
Yes, ma'am. After Madam Chair, members of the board, just a few of the items to cover. The Employee Health and Wellness Fair is actually tomorrow at Carysbrook. It's going to be outside in the softball field, although it's going to be pretty warm out tomorrow. But if in inclement weather, we'll move it inside. But the health fair is co-sponsored by Nationwide Insurance Company and then First Financial Group of America, who we are affiliated with both of those for supporting our staff. But we're also getting lunch provided by Blimpies bringing in sandwiches for the staff. So it was a very good event last year and really a big turnout. So if you can make it, it's between 11:30 and 1:30 tomorrow at the Carey's Brook softball field. And I'd like to recognize Lieutenant Walls and Deputy Ayers from the Sheriff's Office. They did another really great job last weekend during the drug take-back at both the local pharmacy at CVS Pharmacy and at Pleasant Grove during the Earth Day celebration, and took back over 200 pounds of medications that would otherwise have ended up in someone's wrong mouth, or in the landfill, or in the toilet down in our sanitary sewer system. So these will be properly disposed of, so we appreciate their hard work on that. The first ever Earth Day event last week went really well. It was very well attended. There was about 700 people that showed up. But I really appreciate all the clerks and Parks and Rec staff who did a lot of work in setup and organizing that, and out there sweating and humping hard trying to get all the tires loaded in the trucks. And we had tire after tire and chemical after chemical show up, which is a good thing because that means they won't be in someone's ditch or in the backyard or along the roadside. And so it's a good way to get hazardous materials out of our county. Lots of booths from different organizations around the county, and did some trail work that day with the Charlotte's Ferry Mountain Bike Club volunteers as well. Here's some of the pictures of that event. You can see the truckloads of tires that were getting loaded up, and then these chemicals and paints and solvents and things that were collected, and tire after tire, there were several semi-tractor trail loads of old tires. So, and then the Easter egg hunt was, I think, the weekend before that, and that was actually very well attended too. You can about 450 people showed up, but this year was really well organized. The staff did such a great job, and Farm Bureau came out. A lot of folks helped volunteer. There was face painting. But there were 6,000 eggs out there for the kids, and they set up the areas really widespread, and so all the kids had a really great opportunity to go out there without tripping over each other, and the parents running the kids over, and it was really great, and the mother was perfect for it, so a lot of fun. For business news, Community Investment Collaborative, they do that 17-week training course for entrepreneurs. Savannah County residents that go to that have the ability to also get microfinance loans potentially after they finish the course. But they're doing an information session here at the Savannah County Library on the 17th of June. And so we'll have that annotated in our fan mail and online. But that's at 6 p.m. on the 17th of June. And it'll tell people about what the class is about and what the commitments involves. But it's a really great training class for small businesses. And the Barbecue Bands and Brews is getting pretty close, Saturday, June 28th. And this year it's going to be a patron-judged barbecue event with local barbecue vendors. And I think for $5 you can sample all the different barbecue from the different vendors and then also put your vote in to select the best barbecue from that day. There will also be a local winery, Thistlegate, and a number of local brews from around the Central Virginia area will be there, as well as I think 6 bands are coming that day too. We have a Twitter account. I've had a Twitter account under Fluvanna County Administrator for a while, and normally send out a tweet once a week that what the upcoming board meeting is, or significant events or accomplishments, the things that the board has voted on. But I've converted it over just to at Fluvanna County, and so we'll use that for Parks and Rec events or board meetings or things like that for those that use Twitter. And the tweets normally go out on Mondays, but we can send them more frequently if people have questions. And it's linked on our website. You can just go to the Savannah County website and click the tweet link up in the top corner and see the items or follow that Savannah County account. Mr. Rodish and a number of other staff were working trying to get rid of a lot of excess equipment and materials. They sold over $8,000 worth of excess property in the last week. And there's two or three more vehicles getting ready to be sold now. So we'll be down to just a couple excess vehicles to get off our lots and cleaning off the basement in the admin building, because there's a lot of stuff there. But finally, the big old voting machines were finally taken out for scrap. So no one in the state wanted them, even historic agencies. They're not quite old enough to be historic, but not quite young enough to be useful either. But they were very heavy, so they made great scrap metal. And then your next two board meetings are the June 4th. I'm skipping one. May 21st is your next regular meeting at 7 p.m. But on June 4th, then you'll have your regular afternoon meeting like this one. And the evening work session is on county facility space utilization, and then a strategic initiatives update, and then your regular meeting on June 18th. Probably at the June meeting, we'll take a look, or maybe at the May 21st meeting, take a look on any work sessions you want for later in the summer. I don't have anything else planned other than the one for tonight and the one for June, but we'll take a look at that and identify any items you may want to put on for those. And then in August, of course, you just have the one combined meeting. Any questions I can answer for the board?
Any questions?
No.
All right. I will now open the first public comments time. If you come to the mic, please, and give your name and address, and address the board. You have 5 minutes. Anyone would like to address the board? Okay, then we will close the first public comment section. We do not have a public hearing this afternoon, so we move on into our action items. The first one is community volunteer coordinator position, and this is from Mr. Nichols, county administrator.
Yes, ma'am. In February, when I presented the county administrator's draft budget, I listed a number of items in there that I thought would be appropriate to work on in the future, and one of the commitments in there was to bring to you within the subsequent 90 days a proposal to establish a community volunteer coordinator position. And so that's what is here tonight. The position description and the information was in your package, but I think this is a good way for us to take best advantage of the talented residents we have. It's really hard for staff to get out and coordinate all these kinds of things all the time, and if we had a community volunteer coordinator, they could interface with agencies and organizations and nonprofits and county staff and Parks and Rec and things like that for where volunteer services may be useful. Plus, the person could help be an information conduit, get the word out about events and volunteer activities, and also track volunteer services in our county. We really don't track very well the amount of volunteer hours that we use. We do sometimes a little bit for the Parks and Rec events, but there are a lot of folks that volunteer on behalf of the county or in our county, and it'd be great to get a better handle on that. This would be an unpaid volunteer position, and all I'm recommending is that the person be reimbursed for local mileage if they're going to meetings or if we send them to training, that they would be to a local training class that we would cover the cost of training. But the position description, as part of your packet, outlines that and outlines the duties and responsibilities. This is a position that will be aligned under the Office of the County Administrator and support my office and staff in really being the focal point for volunteer activities in our county. Unpaid, but I think it may be useful. I would propose bringing this person on for a year, establishing the program, seeing how it works. If it doesn't work out, if it doesn't make sense, then we wouldn't follow up on it. But I think this one is a good way to strengthen our volunteer activities in our county.
Mm-hmm. Do we have some questions about this volunteer coordinator position?
You already have a few
applicants. I have no applicants. I have two people that have mentioned to me that they wanted to, but we hadn't put it out yet formally. This is now be out formally. What I would propose is once this is done, I will then put a notice in fan mail on the website and things like that. And all I really want, I don't want the boards, commissions, and committees application. I just want to cover that in a brief resume so that I can call through those and meet with those folks and then select someone to take their job.
You're going to select?
Yes.
And the training, I think there was a training component.
Well, there may or may not be training. If there's training available that would be appropriate for this person, we might find those local training opportunities. But I'm really looking for someone that has kind of a background in coordinating activities and groups and things like that, so that they could be the conduit between the Partnership for Aging and what they need, and Parks and Rec and what they need, and the local organization and what they need, and help us make sure that our website lists the most current up-to-date volunteer activities that are available in our county. And I really envision this to be in a 3, 4, 6, 8 hours a week commitment. I don't think this is a full-time job in any means, and I think some weeks there may not be anything going on. But I really want somebody that has the technical capability to access a county email account that knows a little bit about PowerPoint and Word and Excel to be able to do some statistics, and not stats, but to track data and collect reports and collect information. So it will take someone with certain types of skills, but that's described in the position description.
You wouldn't need to do any kind of a background check on the individual because they would not be any contact with kids or...
The person is not the one who's going to do the volunteer activity.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll check with the HR office. I can ask Mrs. Parrish and see what she thinks. But I wouldn't necessarily think so because they're not the one who is the volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
They're really an information conduit, somebody who maybe goes to a meeting periodically and talks about volunteer activities in the county,
mm-hmm.
Comes to staff meetings here to ask department heads and directors, are there volunteer activities that would support their departments that would be useful they can get the word out on. If they start being a regular volunteer, like on Parks and Rec activities,
mm-hmm.
they'll have the same background checks or checks that other people would have
right,
to.
Right, if there's any contact with
right.
kids.
Sure.
So we can have a $6 to $8 a week person that's we don't have to pay.
This is definitely not, I'm definitely not requesting this to be a paid position. And I don't know if I'll get any applicants for it,
mm-hmm.
but I've already had several people express interest.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a county employee.
No.
Right.
This is a volunteer position.
Okay.
Sounds like a pretty tough job.
Yeah, it does.
There is a fair amount there.
Yeah,
they're very well paid.
That's the nice part.
Uh-huh.
From a certain perspective.
But there are a lot of people that like to...
There's a lot of folks that are good at this kind of
mm-hmm.
stuff that maybe aren't working now or wanted an extra thing to do or something of interest.
Right.
I think there are lots of talented community volunteers that would
mm-hmm.
be interested in this. If it grows to be a lot of work, because there's a lot of things there, maybe we'll have a volunteer and an assistant volunteer coordinator.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one of the things I think we miss in Fluvanna County is the incredible amount of volunteerism that's already going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I would really like to have kind of a central clearinghouse to kind of track that and keep an eye on that. And also then, when someone new moves to the county, they want to know how they can volunteer, how they can get involved. You can go to your church, you can ask, you can go to schools and ask and stuff, but there's no kind of central clearinghouse for that stuff that, hey, I have skills in doing such and such. You got any idea where I can go help? And they
right.
can send an email to volunteer@fluvannacounty.org and then get a response back
mm-hmm.
and with some ideas and links
yeah.
to websites or things like that.
Now, I know the school system had a person doing their volunteering, but that's a little different.
It is a little different because the requirements for some of those volunteers
yes.
are different.
Mm-hmm.
This person would not necessarily be doing the screening
right.
or be doing checks on people. It's really linking volunteer needs from organizations
mm-hmm.
and volunteer desires from community members
right.
and linking those groups up. They still have to have whatever screening would be required from,
sure.
from that organization, but this is really an information conduit person that would help my office make sure that, when that person hears about things or when I hear about things, I hear about, hey, there's a activity coming off the parks, let's get the word out about that. They can do a little blurb and get it into fan mail and,
mm-hmm.
and get it out to folks.
Okay.
I move to approve the creation of community volunteer coordinator and unpaid volunteer position organized under the office of the county administrator.
Second.
All right, it has been moved by Mr. Allenbrook and seconded by Mr. Weaver. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? The chair votes aye, so that's 4. And we have Mr. Sheridan is absent. Mr. Nichols, your next topic,
yes,
boards. Commissions.
Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
A meeting or two ago, we looked at boards, commissions, and committees pay and tried to show you in what our what we pay here for those boards, committees, and commissions that we provide compensation for, and comparing that to other areas, other counties and localities around our area. And so you remember this big spreadsheet that had all those numbers on there. At that meeting, you, in general, agreed with a number of changes to our compensation list starting July 1st. And so this is the result of that. A number of these boards and commissions and committees already are paid for their work. Some are paid $50 a meeting, some are paid an annual stipend per year, and they're included in our payroll system, so they get paid every 2 weeks. The current compensation levels were set back in 2008, as you recall. The review was conducted of the surrounding area, so that big spreadsheet had all the compensation comparisons, and two of them that really looked significantly lower than the area was the Board of Supervisors and the Planning Commission. And as we talked about last time, we can't do anything about the Board of Supervisors' compensation until after July of next year, when there's an election coming, and then the new rates, if you chose to do new rates, could go into effect in January of 2016. But this is the chart showing the numbers we talked about at the last meeting. The Planning Commission currently is at $1,500 per member. The proposal is to take them to $2,400 for the chair and $2,100 for the Planning Commission, or for the other Planning Commission members and the Board of Supervisors rep. Now, those numbers are still pretty substantially low, below some of the area averages, but it's a pretty big increase, and a pretty good increase for folks that have a lot of meetings every year and do a lot of work. Social Services Board, they've just been really adjusted to the rate that was really incorrectly paid. They were getting paid their 24 times a year, divided by 24 times a year, was being paid 26 times a year, so we're just adjusting to that. That's still in very good numbers compared to other social services boards around the areas. Electoral board, that's set by the state. And in the annual letter that comes out from the state electoral board, it says, here is the remuneration for electoral board members, for the secretary, for the chair, and for the vice chair. It does not say in there that, oh, by the way, you can supplement that like it does for the registrar. So my recommendation is just go by what that letter is. The current number is this 2064.50 and 41.29. That's currently what should be in our payroll system starting July 1st. But then about the middle of July, we'll get a new letter, and they normally have been going up about $100 a year.
Well, those numbers, they're like $4,514, that total board. Where did those come from? Were they mandated by the state, or how did we come up with those numbers?
No, so what happened is in 2008, when the recommendation was made to move board, commission, and committee members into the payroll system, because they were really considered employees for that purpose, their pay went into the payroll system. And at the time, the Board of Supervisors, based on staff recommendations, said, okay, the $50 they used to get, we're going to make that $58.50 to take into account the taxes we're now going to be taking out. So theirs got plussed up at the time, and it's just stayed plussed up the whole time. And it's just been a little bit above what the state number has been all the way. And the same way with Social Services Board and others, because of the taxes and because of the because of the 24 times a year versus 26.
Right.
So while this is a little bit of a decrease, I understand that. I think we've been paying inappropriately on those for the electoral board, and the audit, when we went through the internal audit, we looked at those numbers and tried to match it all up. And I got a copy of the year before letter and this last year's letter, and then we'll get another one in July, so they'll adjust. But that's what the numbers are supposed to be for electoral boards.
Okay, and you've already spoken to the electoral board about this.
I have not talked to electoral board members ourselves. The reason I haven't yet is because they were still figuring out who was going to be on the board. I think they just named Mr. Leipold the other day, and I'm not sure. I'm not sure who the other ones are yet, because they were changing. I think two of them. But I will brief the electoral board and the registrar. I think I already gave this. I'm positive I already gave the information to the registrar to explain that we would be paying based on, if the board approved it, based on what the electoral board, state electoral board letter says. And Ms. Pace and I have been corresponding on that, but I haven't spoken to the electoral board myself. And then the jail board would just stay at $85 a meeting. Board of Zoning Appeals, $60 a meeting. Those haven't changed in some time, but the jail board is a per meeting number, and so is the BZA. The BZA hasn't met since March of 2010, so they're not paying that now. The Board of Equalization, you agreed earlier in the budget cycle, to take them to $20 an hour versus $15, where they've been for many years. So really the two substantive changes here that I would ask you to approve to would be the Planning Commission, and then just acknowledge these other rates, because the rest of them are really just settling out of the rates in the way they're supposed to be. But your motion would be approving this chart. I'll come back to the board in next year with the Board of Supervisors recommendations, and also potentially that time with James River Water Authority, because that board is pretty active and meeting on a regular basis. But the county staff that's on the board here in Louisa wouldn't receive pay for that, but citizens who are on that board, it may be appropriate to do a $50 per meeting stipend, because they spend a lot of time in their meetings doing a lot of research and then drive back and forth too, like some of these other boards. But since that's a new one, we'll let it settle in and then bring it back after the
meeting. On the jail board, what if they don't attend a meeting?
They don't get paid.
They don't get paid.
We get a letter from the jail that says who attended. So, for instance, Mr. Haney almost always goes, because we really try to want to get one there, but sometimes the sheriff is tied up and was just not available to go. And when it comes in, it lists who attended and what meetings, and they only get paid for the meetings they attend.
Okay. Before they didn't pay it off, because I was on the jail board.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
So are you mad? Are you mad because it? Cause
yeah, I'm mad.
You want back pay?
I'm mad.
Yeah. Yeah, right. There you go.
Yeah, they have for at least 5 or 6 years, I know, because it's in the records from 2008 that listed them there. I'm not sure about before that.
Mm-hmm.
But this has been the current number in there. So essentially, that kind of covers all your boards, committees, and commissions, and the motion would be approving this chart.
Is there a conflict of interest in voting for compensation increase for ourselves?
You're not very good. Except for you.
Yeah.
You're not good. No, I don't think so, because you are
a member of
it. You are, you're a member that affects yourself only casually, because the board, you serve at the board's pleasure on the Planning Commission. So I don't think that's a conflict of interest.
Okay, we have a motion.
It's about 50 cents an hour anyway.
Yeah, pretty high pay you're getting over there.
Yeah. All right, we have a motion. Do we have someone that would like to make the motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move to adopt a new compensation plan for the Fluvanna County Record Standards on the following boards, commissions, and committees, effective July the 1st, 2015, with the annual increase of $2,341 to be transferred to the FY15 personnel contingency.
Have a second. All right, it has been moved by Mr. Weaver and second by Mr. Allenbrook. All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? The chair votes aye, so that's 4, with Mr. Sheridan's absence. Vacancy in the office of sheriff.
Yes, ma'am. Mr. Payne had done some research for us to make sure we had the right paperwork that would go to the clerk, to the circuit court judge, to authorize us, or to recommend a special election to fill the vacancy in the sheriff's position. By state code, the chief deputy automatically fills in as interim sheriff, although the sheriff Hess was actually sworn in last week as well. But this package that is before you lists a writ and a petition to the circuit court judge to establish a special election in conjunction with the November general election for the position of sheriff in Fluvanna County. Mm-hmm. And so this is the kind of the legal language for that was in your package.
Right.
And all you'll be doing is adopting those two documents that are attached to your package, the writ of election and the petition to the circuit court judge.
It could have been brought earlier, could it not have?
Well, statute says it's to be brought within 15 days after the effective date of the resignation, unless the resignation...
The resignation.
I'm not sure exactly what the alternative is, but if you know it's going to happen, then you can do it. Mm-hmm. My recommendation was to wait until it actually happens.
Right.
There's no particular rush on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that I do think you should note. It caused some confusion initially, is what happens when the sheriff, when the office becomes vacant. And the answer is that the constitutional officers have a different succession statute than the other officers. So you may recall having this come up with the last one I recall was when Mr. Sheridan resigned to take his office as a constitutional officer. In that case, the board makes the appointment for the interim, and then there's the writ of election. That's the way it works for board members. It's not the way it works for constitutional officers. So there's no particular urgency in doing it as long as it's done within the 15 days, since it's by statute totally seamless. Sheriff Hess simply takes over, succeeds to the office from having been chief deputy. Now, I have the original petition and writ if you all are disposed to approve it. I've already asked my associate to file it tomorrow morning.
There could have been a July election.
You can't do it within, my memory is you can't do it within 90 days of the resignation. So you couldn't have a July. No, you couldn't have a July. You could have it in August.
When's the primaries?
I don't remember. I haven't looked at that.
I don't know that there's a primary this year.
I looked at the statute. I don't remember the answer to that question.
I don't have any problem with the way that you're doing it and having it in November. I was just curious, and I knew there were some other pending statutes that could have changed that. Or maybe, if the board wanted to.
But then if you read the one, the circuit court is then required to issue the writ of assignment. Then it talks provisions for other dates are not applicable in this case with the resignation filed in April and effective May 2nd. And that was a circuit court
version. I have a statute here if you're really interested in it.
Right.
I think I do.
I think this is all right the way it is.
Okay.
So the writ will be filed tomorrow.
It would have been filed today except the clerk's office is closed.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, I think we have a motion.
I move to approve the petition of the Brandon County Board of Supervisors for a special election to fill the vacancy in the office of the sheriff.
Okay, second. All right, we have a motion by Mr. Ullenbrook and second by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. So that's 4 against the Sheridan absent. We have some appointments.
So we have one member requesting an appointment to the Flavetta Partnership for Aging, the at-large position. Member, a number of weeks ago you appointed. There are one per election district and two at-large. This is at-large position, and Ms. Stephanie Fick from, I think, Cunningham District is applying for the at-large position.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does that finally fill the...
You have one more at-large to fill, I believe.
Whose district?
No, one more at-large.
One more at-large.
So that covers everything.
Did Columbia get filled? Oh, so Columbia is still empty and one at-large. So this will be 5 that you have. You have 4 plus this one at-large, I think, is what you'll have now.
All right. So we need to motion in...
Don, you want to do that?
For Cunningham.
We just had one application.
Stephanie Flick.
I move to appoint Stephanie Flick to the Flavetta Partnership for Aging at Large position with a term to begin immediately and to terminate December 31st, 2017.
Okay, we have a motion. Second. It is moved by Mr. Weaver and second by Mr. Ullenbrook. All in favor?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. So we have 4 with Mr. Sheridan absent. We have another appointment to our CPMT.
With the recent resignation of Mr. Ott, due to other commitments, we have one applicant for that vacant position on the Community Policy team. That's Mr. William Hughes,
mm-hmm.
who also serves on our Board of Directors.
Job
of Board of Directors.
Yeah. We have a motion, please.
I move to appoint Mr. Hughes to the Community Policy and Management team, Citizens Representative. Position with term to begin immediately and terminate December 31, 2014. This position replaces Mr. Ott.
Okay. All right. It has been moved by Mr. Ullenbrook and seconded by Mr. Bryan. All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? We have, and chair votes aye, so we have 4, and with Mr. Sheridan's absence. Now we have our presentations. We have VDOT with us today, and all of you brought your red books. Yes.
And Mr. Greg Banks is with us today. Mr. Delenzo is not available. But we got the one who actually knows everything anyway. I'll let him know.
You forgot your red. Don and I are the only people that follow directions.
I see a blue book out there.
Apple today.
Is it we get an apple?
You and I get an apple.
Okay.
It appears Mr. Weaver there may have a blue book, I'm not sure. I think that was last year's possibly, I'm not sure. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the board. I would like to present to you a booklet of information I prepared for the update of the secondary six-year plan. The update of the secondary six-year plan is something that we do once a year. We will have a public hearing to receive comments in conjunction with the updated secondary six-year plan here on June 4th at 4 p.m. I'm here today to give you an overview of your last year's secondary six-year plan and provide you with a draft copy of the upcoming secondary six-year plan. Of course, it is at this point a draft and is at the pleasure of the Board of Supervisors to make any changes at this point. In the red booklet, I believe that some of you may have, under tab 1, you'll see the proposed allocations for the updated secondary six-year plan. There are two funding streams in this year's secondary six-year plan. They are CTB formula and paved state, and this particular funding category is one that applies only to gravel roads. Is of funds that has to be used for the hard surfacing of gravel roads, and then with one stipulation of that road has to carry at least 50 vehicles per day. Now, last year we had the same exact fund type. It carried a stipulation of having to carry at least 200 vehicles per day, so that is a change from last year. That threshold has been lowered significantly, which is of great significance here in Fluvanna County, where last year there was only one road that eclipsed that threshold of 200 vehicles per day. With that lowering to 50, there are certainly several more candidates that potentially could be funded as a result of that lowering. The second fund type is the telefee fund. This fund type has no restriction as what type of road it could be used on, other than it has to be used on a secondary road. It could be used on paved roads, gravel roads, so there's less restrictions on that particular fund type. Under tab 2, you will see some facts about Fluvanna County here. About 299 miles of secondary roads here within Fluvanna County, of that which about 280 miles are paved. So nearly about 19 miles of non-hard surface, so gravel roads, remain here in Fluvanna County, which is not a large amount in comparison to many other counties that I visit. Of that 19 miles, only about 4.84 qualify for hard servicing, meaning that they carry at least that 50 vehicles per day or greater. So certainly a very small number of roads that qualify for some hard servicing. Of that 4.84 that qualify, 2.94 are currently in the secondary six-year plan. So there's a very small number of roads that are in the plan that qualify for hard servicing. There at the bottom, I have a tab there about the cost of building hard surface and gravel roads of $800,000 per mile. That's certainly an estimate that is all over the place. We've been very successful in recent years in hard surface and roads under a method called the rural rustic method, which is considerably cheaper. We've done that on several roads here recently. We've seen estimates significantly reduced from that as low as a couple hundred thousand dollars a mile. So estimates, depending on the scope of work, can change drastically. Under tab 3 is some acronyms about the secondary six-year plan, and I won't go into those a great deal, other than most projects we have a PE phase, a right-of-way phase, and a construction phase. And each phase has to be fully funded before we move to the next. Obviously, PE would be first, right-of-way, and then construction. Our rural rustic projects do not have the right-of-way phase. We're able to hard surface existing gravel roads within the existing prescriptive right-of-way without obtaining any additional right-of-ways for the most normal rural rustic projects. To bring you up to date, I have in here on the tab 4 the existing secondary six-year plan. This is a plan that was approved last year on May 21st, it appears. And I will quickly run through the priorities that were in last year's secondary six-year plan. The first priority was a box culvert drainage improvement on Route 632, Ridge Road over Ballinger Creek. This project has been completed for a short period of time, and we are currently finishing completing paying all the bills on that project, but construction has completed. completed at this time. It's a fair chance that that project will remain in the update of the secondary six-year plan, just from a standpoint of finishing paying off a few remaining bills. But as far as construction goes, that construction is complete. The next priority is South Boston Road, Route 600. This is a roundabout, the intersection improvement of Route 653. This project may be in the same boat. I believe last time I checked, there may have been a condemnation case on this one as well. But I will clarify that between now and June 4th. It may or may not be in the secondary six-year plan in the future. However, as I stated before, it is complete from that standpoint. The next priority that was in secondary six-year plan last year is Route 656 Bremer Road. This is a bridge replacement over Holman Creek. The next priority last year's secondary six-year plan was Stagg Road, Route 715. This was a rural rustic route, paving from Route 694 to interstate maintenance. This project has been completed, I'm happy to report, and we will be able to remove this project from the secondary six-year plan with this year's update. The next project was Priority 5, Hells Bend Road, Route 606. This project started construction last year. We went in, we did a good bit of ditching work, replaced the pipes, put down all the stone. However, weather caught us before we were able to stabilize that roadway and give it its final surface treatment shot. That's a project that we will begin here shortly, and hard surfacing that roadway, and it will be complete in the near future. Certainly, we remain in the secondary six-year plan this year. However, it will be completed. I've been told as soon as the 1st of July, we hope to have that along with several other projects here I'll be mentioning complete by the 1st of July.
But that's definitely not the entire Hell's Bend Road.
Not the entire, but the
first section of it down to where it spurs off.
That's correct. The section that's in the plan goes from Route 608 to 609.
Okay.
Yeah. Excuse me. The next project in the secondary six-year plan was a project that was added last year. It's Route 600 North Boston Road from Route 616 to Route 633. This project has a fair amount of previous funding on it, although there is a balance that was funded in future years in the secondary six-year plan. This project is already a hard surface road, and so as a result of that, it receives the telefee funding that I spoke of previously under tab 1. The next project was added last year as well. This is a continuation of the previous project I just spoke about. It's on Route 633, runs from Route 600 to 631. As you can see, there is a substantial balance to complete beyond the life of the secondary six-year plan on this project. There are funds in years 4, 5, and 6 of last year's plan. However, there is additional $2.2 million in more than $2.2 million to complete this project beyond the life of the secondary six-year plan. Again, this project is already a hard surface road. It'd be to widen that particular road, so this would be available for the telefee funds. The next project was an addition last year to Route 621 Lantry Road. This project is fully funded. It is under construction, to my understanding, speaking to Mr. Ruhlman. It is under construction. We have done some of the pipe work and some grading and are bringing in stone now. This is falling into the category as Hell's Bend. It's a project we hope to have completed by the 1st of July. The next project, Canal Street, is much like Lantry Road. Construction has commenced on this project. We hope to have it completed by July as well. As you can see in the plan here, this project was fully funded as well. Radisil Circle, Route 687. Again, this project has not started construction yet. However, it's a very short construction project, and we hope to have it completed by July 1 as well. Again, following the same theme of the previous projects, this project was fully funded as well. So as you can see, up to this point, every gravel road project in the plan is fully funded, either built or under construction. Now, this last project here in the plan is Route 636 Garden Lane. This particular project was added last year because it carried, by our traffic counts, more than 200 vehicles per day. As a result of that, it was added into the plan last year. This is a continuation of a previous project that was in the plan. I believe that this traffic count here, and speaking to county staff, is probably over-exaggerated and probably taken from a portion of road, and I say that kind of tongue-in-cheek, taken from a portion of road prior to this actual segment here, although it lies on the same road. Talking to staff and looking at this section of road here, it is our recommendation to drop this particular project from the secondary six-year plan at this time, since that threshold of 200 vehicles per day has dropped to 50 vehicles per day, allowing us to use these funds on other priorities here within the county.
Did you say Garden Lane?
This is Garden Lane, yes, ma'am.
Is that located?
There were multiple Keys is?
Yeah.
On 53?
Uh-huh.
The road next to it was paved last year or the year before, all the way back to the Aqua Virginia plant.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, there was only one home that accesses that road. It's the white barn house off to the left, and it's right at the very end of the pavement. From that back to Jefferson Drive inside the lake is just a gravel road, and there are no homes back there at all, just the backs of properties inside the lake, Lake Montchel property. I live right there, so I run and walk on that road all the time. I've never seen a vehicle on that road beyond the blacktop.
Right.
And that's what we're talking about, is paving from there to the chain link, to the chain fence that goes across it, because you can't enter Lake Monticello. But it's like an emergency exit entrance, or for big trucks and things like that, where they end up.
They were supposed to have put a wooden guardrail at the end of that road.
Instead of the chain?
Yes.
I hope not, because that's harder to get my bike over.
Yeah, that was typed about a year and a half ago.
Because lots of kids come through there. It may be 200 a day, but it's 200 kids a day.
Sure.
That come up that road and then through our subdivision, through the woods to Food Line.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there's lots and lots that come that way. But I've never seen a vehicle on the road off the hardtop, because the hardtop ends at the last driveway.
And last year, we only had one traffic count on that entire segment, on that entire road, 636 from 53 to Dead End. So we made use of that and allocated those funds.
Yeah.
Now that threshold has been lowered, we would like to delete that project and add another project in its place.
I've had complaints, people backing, turn around at the end there, and knocking over trees and damaging trees that are actually supposedly in.
Yeah, I think you and I both have been up there to look at that.
Yeah, I've done a U-turn. You can't do a U-turn, you have to do a Y-turn. But I've turned down there at least 6 or 8 times myself. And I can do it easily in my Volvo without damaging anything. The only thing close that you're going to touch is little scrub stuff. I mean, just a little brush, but no trees, because the edge of the road actually kind of goes up where the trees start. But it's not big enough to turn around in, really, unless you're very careful.
So that's why we got the okay, and I think you probably remember that, we talked about either metal barrier or wooden ones, and said they put wooden ones in to mix with the location. And so that's never been done. It was told to us it was going to be done, and that was a year and a half ago.
Who put those in?
VDOT.
Oh. So you're talking about at the end of the blacktop before it turns to gravel?
No, at the end of the road.
Oh. But that's not going to stop you from going down there and turning around.
It protects the property. I'm regardless whether you say that there can be damage or not, we both had complaints.
Okay.
That's been an ongoing thing.
Okay, well, we can talk afterwards. Yeah. I mean, I'm back there all the time, and I'm not sure which side it is.
I'm just sort of shocked it wasn't done when we were told it was going to be done.
I've never heard of that discussion.
It may have been on the board.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's before you.
Yeah.
I'll bring it to Joel's attention and see that he's aware of it.
Check and see.
Okay. Under tab 5 is a simple breakdown of traffic counts of all the secondary routes here within Fluvanna County. You'll see some of those segments are highlighted in yellow, which denotes that those particular segments or a portion of those segments is included in the secondary 6-year plan. And you'll see P or U over on the far right column. That simply indicates paved or unpaved. AADT is the traffic count in which the data is collected, is right there beside it. I'm going to spend a tremendous amount of time there. However, if you turn over on page 6, tab 6, that's all of your unpaved roads broken out separately. Tab 7 is all of your unpaved roads with a traffic count of 50 vehicles per day or greater. And this is the 4.84 miles that I mentioned over on tab 2, I believe. You'll see several of these roads are already highlighted in yellow, meaning that they are included in the secondary 6-year plan. As I stated before, there's only a little better than a mile that's not in the plan at this time that qualifies. As I also stated before, we have fully funded and either constructed or began construction on every single gravel road project in the plan. So you see the need there. It's likely a need, there is a need, to identify some additional projects for gravel roads here within Fluvanna County. Tab 8 is some federally eligible roads. However, this year and last several years, there have not been any federal funds available. Under tab 9, you'll see a recommendation, and it says the department recommends adding at least one additional unpaved road project to the secondary six-year plan with this year's update. The department also recommends developing a prioritized list of projects that could be added to the secondary six-year plan with future updates as funding allows. I think I mentioned here of it adding at least one additional unpaved road. In preparation of this meeting, I went through and developed a draft plan prior to meeting with you all, showing potentially adding two gravel road projects. Obviously, I'll go over that with you in just a moment and show you what those are. And it's simply just that it's a recommendation. We would like to work with you all to see what your thoughts are, what your priorities are, and what potential roads we could add. Certainly, we don't have a tremendous amount of latitude in what we could do as far as the number of roads that potential candidates based on traffic count. Moving along to tab 10, you'll see a list of potential projects to add to the plan as funding allows. This is kind of somewhat of a historical list of projects that were in the plan in years past, however, dropped due to funding constraints. There are at least two, I believe, gravel roads on this list here. Tab 11 goes through and spells out different means in which we can hard surface gravel roads, whether it be through the traditional method of widening and obtaining additional right-of-ways, or with our more rustic methods, which I mentioned here just a moment ago, we see considerable cost savings. Tab 12 is code section, all about the secondary six-year plan, why we do a plan, how often we do a plan, and I won't bother you with reading all of that. Tab 13 is a petition. This particular one is set up for a traditional widening type project. It's nothing binding about it. It's just to determine if there's an intent along a roadway for property owners to dedicate necessary right-of-ways for the widening of a road. As I stated before, we kind of have moved more towards rural rustic type projects where that wouldn't be the case, where this particular form is set up. Tab 14 is some contact information, and finally tab 15 is a map of Nevada County highlighting the existing priorities in the secondary six-year plan. Now, prior to the meeting, I had county staff pass out a draft secondary six-year plan, and this was simply an attempt by myself to kind of put some stuff on paper, show you where we've come from last year based on these recommendations and where we may be. And again, this is simply just to put something on paper, a working document. Would like you all's input. As I stated before, Ridge Road, South Boston Road, while they are complete, there may be a few bills left to pay on those. So for purposes of showing them in the plan, I showed them there at the top. They're not listed as a priority one or two. They're listed as a zero with a one just for numbering purposes. The next project, just through attrition, would be Bremer Road. This is a bridge project I mentioned before over Holman Creek down near Bremer Bluff. Next project is Hells Bend Road, which I mentioned before.
Excuse me? Which bridge is that? Is that the one by the power plant?
Yes, ma'am, it is. Yes,
one
ma'am.
Where we had the terrible death.
I'm not aware, but yes, ma'am. The next project is Hells Bend Road, Route 606. As I stated before, this project has been under construction, started last year, and we hope to complete it here by the 1st of July. Yes, sir.
Are y'all doing both sides of that?
No, sir.
Just the one side. I asked that.
That's correct. Okay. That's correct. And the reason being that the rest of the circle, the traffic count lowers and falls below the 50 vehicle per day threshold on the count of which we have today. The next priority through attrition again is North Boston Road. This project, as I mentioned before, was added last year along with Route 633. Lantry, Lane, Canal Street, Radisville Circle, these are all projects that were in the plan last year just moving up due to Stag Road coming off due to it being completed, Route 715. The last three projects, the first of the last three, Stone Lake Road, would be an addition. If you flip over on tab 7 from what we talked about before, there's only a few roads that remain in Fluvanna County that qualify for actual hard surfacing based on the traffic count, this being one. There are a few others, and for one reason or another, we kind of weeded through some of those and came up with Stone Lake Road as a potential candidate for hard surfacing. You'll see the majority of the CTB formula unpaid funds going towards it in years 1 through 6. As one of the larger ways a lot of these projects are completed is by completion of projects prior to, and being able to finish them under the estimate, and those surplus allocations rolling down to the next project. That's what we've seen with several projects here in past years. So while it looks pretty bleak, the Stone Lake Road may be 6 years out, we would hope to potentially advance that some with the completion of a Lantry Lane, a Canal Street, a Rattlesnake Circle, some of those. Hopefully some surpluses would flow down through to that particular project.
Stoneley is the one right across the street here.
Right across the street.
Across the street. It circles up from here and goes back to
608. I might add that project was in the plan some years ago and I think dropped out due to funding constraints. Second project, new project to be added is Route 714 Union Church Road. This is a very short segment of road, pretty wide, easily done, pretty low cost, Route 714 Union Church Road.
Where is Union Church?
Offshore.
Offshore?
Yeah.
Is that right there, Mr. Woodson?
Mr. Woodson.
I'm wondering if that's it.
Oh, I know what you're talking about now. Uh-huh. Yeah.
That'd be close.
Yeah,
sure,
must be the church road.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Not all
right.
Right
down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then finally, there's a project that I'll show here in the secondary six-year plan in the draft, kind of for situational awareness. This particular project, you'll see some pretty substantial sums of money coming on board in the next 4 years, and it's not funded by way of this document through the secondary six-year plan. It's funded through our central office CTB bridge funds, but since it lies within Fluvanna County on a secondary route for your own purposes, I want to make you aware of it. It's a Route 629 bridge project, bridge replacement over Deep Creek Road. On Deep Creek Road, over the middle fork of Kent's Branch. And as you can see, over the course of the next 4 years, it is fully funded. I would only caution you that this is draft allocations. We have not received, of course, we've not done a final secondary six-year plan, nor a final...
Is that the bridge right next to Dogwood, the one-lane bridge?
I'm not familiar with the county well enough to say yes or no. I can show you on the map, but yes, it's pretty easily seen. On the tab 15, there is a map.
That's
not marked on that because that's last year's priority. However, if you look up for 629 Middle Fork Kent's Branch, you'll get it. Yes, sir. So that's what the other change was, the removal of Route 636 Garden Lane. So removal of two projects, Garden Lane and Stag Road, because they've been completed, and the addition of those three. That's all I had in regard to the potential draft secondary six-year plan. I'm open to any comments. Unfortunately, I don't have Mr. DeNunzio here with me today to address some of the comments or questions you may have, but I will entertain any more that I can.
He'd just defer to you anyway.
Of course, they have a couple of bridges being taken care of.
Yes, ma'am. Route 6.
Yeah, that one. Route 6. Wow, what? Man, that looks like a lot of work.
Is it going to be a completion
of
the bridge, or you're redoing the bridge there?
I'm not familiar with the design of either one of those.
Yeah.
I called the designer today to see when the completion dates were, and if I'm not mistaken, the Hardware Bridge was somewhere around the end of August next year.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the Rivanna Bridge was somewhere towards the end of November of next year. Some pretty substantial construction. I have seen some of that as well. Yes, sir.
With these projects being impacted by that?
I don't have any idea. These are draft allocations, as I stated before. Obviously, from draft to final allocations, there's always some change. Usually, there's very little change. I don't have a real good feeling of what those final figures may be. I think we're having our public hearing June 4th, which is a little later than normal. I may have those final figures by then and be able to speak to that a little bit more intelligently than today. I'm kind of in the dark on that as well at this point.
And sort of the process of devolution, as they call it, the right of the
I can't speak to devolution. I know very little about that. I can't imagine how it would affect these projects, but I'm no expert on devolution by any means.
Any other questions or
tab 8, and I apologize for being behind. Tab 8, is that the one with all the roads?
Tab 8 is those roads that would be eligible for federal funds,
okay,
meaning that they have a functional classification of major, collector, or greater, which is your more heavily traveled roads.
The dirt roads.
Dirt roads.
Which tab?
I have a couple tabs. Just tab 7 is dirt roads,
okay,
that qualify for hard servicing, meaning that they carry at least 50 vehicles per day or greater. And they're sorted.
Have we ever checked Turner Road?
Actually, I did.
Okay.
Actually, I did. I'd be willing to check it again. It's really wide. It would be an easy project. But unfortunately, it came back less than 50 last time I checked it.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
That was my one thought.
Yes, sir.
I sure wish VDOT had some leftover money that we can go down in the woods where we have people living where we can't even get a fire to a truck in the woods. Y'all don't have any extra money.
Leftover, huh?
We have families that are in the woods that we can't even get a rescue squad in.
There are more driveways.
Uh-huh.
Is this the right time to name?
Sure.
We have several houses that we go to. They actually got the engine down in there today.
Oh, they did.
It surprised me. But we have roads. What would be the process to try and get those possibly under y'all?
Their private lanes.
Sure.
There is a program called the Rural Addition Program, and actually there is a line item in the six-year plan for rural additions. Currently, at this time, there's about $78,000, I just looked really quickly, in Fluvanna County, and $78,000 doesn't do...
If we had somebody to do it, I mean, to go in with a bulldozer and scrape it, would you all pay that, or you all have to do it?
First off, we would have to look at the road and see if it's eligible for the Rural Addition Program. There's quite a few stipulations on determining eligibility into the Rural Addition Program.
All right, so we'll give that to Mr. Nichols.
And those are private.
Yeah, but if he said it's private. No, I'm talking
about... It would be to bring the road into the state system.
That maybe they may qualify for. And it's several houses down this road.
Sure.
You need to have public right-of-way.
Pardon?
You need to have public right-of-way.
That's one of the stipulations.
It does.
50-foot right-of-way.
Yes.
It has to serve at least 3 homes per mile.
It's 3.
It has to be dedicated to public use, that right-of-way, I believe, prior to 1992.
Yeah.
There's several stipulations, so if you all could get with Joel, and I'm sure he would look at those and determine what
might help. Any addresses you want or any roads you want, just let me know.
Okay.
We'll connect with VDOT, and we'll list those, have them give us a report back, and then we'll have them.
The cost is the real sticky point.
It's hard for VDOT to pave driveways.
Mm-hmm.
But that's
all
kind
I
of
mean.
What
this
we,
road
we're
just needs
for.
To be scraped. I mean, it needs to be
widened.
Yeah.
They would have to be brought to state standards, so it's pretty costly. $78,000 doesn't do much.
Okay. When you say minor widening, what does that mean?
In particular, where are you speaking of?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of some of these.
There was a couple of projects, yes, ma'am, I saw mine online, 600-633.
Mm-hmm.
In my mind, those projects were added last year, so we're just starting the survey process. So I don't know that we have a great scope on those yet.
Okay.
Certainly, we'll be looking at the functional classification of the roadway, the traffic count, and seeing what geometric standard applies to that roadway.
Mm-hmm.
For a road like Route 600, I'm not sure what the count is going to be. We could end up with a typical section of 12-foot lanes.
Sure.
Sure about the shoulders, but it would be
that Mr. Chester wanted added last year from Union Mills west out towards Troy, and because people build that back way all the time now to get to the Zion Crossroads. But
certainly, as we
pretty narrow.
As we get that survey in hand and begin some engineering, we'll be working with the county closely to develop a scope for that project.
Okay. Well, we thank you for all the work that you're doing.
Sure.
And great, we're getting some things done. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
One more question. So in terms of looking at widening roads down ways, one of the target areas for the county is the Zion's Crossroads area, PR 215.
Mm.
How does that plan work out? When do you start to look at widening a road up 215 key intersections?
250 is a primary route, obviously. We're here to discuss secondary six-year plan. I can speak to that a bit. I believe Mr. Popowitz is going to be attending a hearing here pretty shortly, and I believe has some priorities of the county that he's going to be speaking to, trying to get funds and trying to get projects added to the secondary 6-year plan, excuse me, to the 6-year improvement program. So my expertise especially is on secondary routes, but that is a separate process and the county's pretty heavily involved with that.
So for instance, the 250, we've reported that to them. We met with BDOT a couple of times on it. The traffic circle down here at 15 and 53, that's one of the ones that's in that group. And the public hearings, when they have them up in Germana, for our region, Germana Community College up in Culpeper, is the ones we attend. I went the last one. Mr. Poppett's going to this one because I've got another meeting that night, but we're always represented at those meetings to make sure we list those items that we're talking about, like 250.
One thing.
Sure.
The secondary roads, do we have any kind of limitations with log trucks, tractor trailers, using those as cut-throughs or anything of that nature? And that's something you may have already answered it.
I haven't, and I'm not... That's not an area of expertise that I'm involved with at all. That would, again, be a Joel question. Unfortunately, as I stated before, he's not able to be here tonight.
Because we've got a big issue right now with Kent's Door. Venable Road is becoming a cut-through.
Sure.
There's nothing to run through there, and all of a sudden come into up to four long trucks.
Sure. If you would want to speak to Joel, then I'm sure, or even relay through that Mr. Nichols here, I'm sure that he would more than welcome to help you with that.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Okay. If there aren't, more questions, then we'd like to thank you.
Thank you.
And our next one is Fortune Center District. Mr. Wayne Stevens, Public Works Director.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the board. As you know, we discussed the Fortune Sanitary District water system and working several times, especially regarding the financial condition. And over the last several months, we've been working through different rate scenarios that might need to come into play in order for the water system to make itself more self-sufficient or self-supporting. And on April 28th, April 8th, pardon me, 2014, we had a special meeting of the Fortune Sanitary District Advisory Committee to discuss the very issues that have to do with rates, an ad valorem tax, a potential ad valorem tax, which is one of the things that the board is empowered to do within the Sanitary District, and the general finances of the Fortune Sanitary District. First thing I'll show you here is this is a map. I plotted this map in AutoCAD over the county mapping system based on the legal description of the sanitary district that is in the original circuit court order that formed the district, and of course the mapping that we have available for the water system. It's a little bit hard to see here, but if you have it on paper and you're looking at it, the dark red line represents the boundaries of the district itself. There are blue lines in there that represent 6-inch water lines. Most of them are accurately depicted. Roger Smith informed me a little while ago that a couple of them are wrong. But there's also several short sections of green in there, which represent 8-inch water mains. 8-inch is the largest water main in the system. And just as an aside, reliable fire flow pretty much comes with 12-inch and larger water lines. So while you can get fire flow off of these lines, and any amount of flow is good, when you open up a hydrant, you really get your best from having 12-inch, sort of a 12-inch spine running through your water system. That map is tilted 90 degrees clockwise, so to your right is north. That's about all on that one, but here we have a history of, or a recent history, if you will, of the FUSD water rates. I was able to trace things back to 1986 with the help of the staff of the Sanitary District Water System. And on July 15th of 1986, you can see that the rate structure has pretty much stayed the same in recent years. But on July 15th of 1986, they adopted a rate of $14 as a minimum monthly charge, which includes your first 2,000 gallons of usage. They adopted a rate of $5.83 per 1,000 gallons for usages in between 2,001 and 300,000 gallons, and then for usages larger than 300,000 gallons, $3 per 1,000 gallons. That's kind of a unique rate structure, as I've said to the advisory committee and possibly to the board a couple times. It is generally policy that you raise per 1,000-gallon rates as usages increase, but there were specific reasons why this was done this way. In 2006, they kept the same basic rate structure, going up a little bit. It basically amounted to about a 10% increase on the minimum charge and roughly 30% increase on the per 1,000-gallon charges when they did a rate increase in 2006. Then in 2010, the current rates were adopted. That represented basically across the board 15% rate increase. When I went to the advisory committee to present the results of my various models, I presented basically five different options that cover the range of what I saw as the different possibilities for how to structure things. Option one included a 5 cent per $100 ad valorem tax, which would be added to the real estate taxes of anybody that lived within the sanitary district. Option five involved a $0 tax. The others ranged somewhere in between. Most important thing to take here is looking at your net revenues from the financial model, which basically shows that under current rates, if you keep going where we are and don't do a single thing, you're going to end up about $1.3 million in the hole after 20 years. And that's at $30,000 to $50,000 a year and increasing costs right now with increasing costs, that's not outside the realm of possibility. But option one, you end up around $75,000 to the good after 20 years. And as you can see, what I generally did there was I tried to make sure that the 20-year total stayed plus or minus $50,000, either $50,000 to the good or $50,000 in the hole, because on a 20-year predictive model, $50,000 or minus $50,000 might as well be zero. You're right in there near the break-even point. So any of these five options would potentially have worked for the sanitary district. But after the discussion that we had...
Can you also cover the payoff of the county?
I'm sorry. $7,000. I should make it clear that this financial model includes paying off the money that is owed to the county over a two-year period, and then in the third year obtaining by some means, possibly with county backing, if you will, a $500,000 loan, if you will, to do the improvements that are needed to the system. Bring on an additional well and then use whatever we have left over to improve water mains, replace water mains that need it. So this isn't just a straight up staying, I guess I was mistaken, it isn't staying exactly the way we were, because it involves doing the work necessary to improve the system.
This is the operating and maintaining.
Right. So we're operating and maintaining, and we're doing the debt service on $500,000, as well as paying, I think, $35,000 a year back to the county in years one and two of the model. So this will help. It will help get us a bit of a better water system in one of these scenarios. Basically, after a lot of discussion about the history of the system, I actually apologize. I wasn't able to find any actual written documentation as to exactly what the history of the last ad valorem tax was. There's a lot of people that have memories of what it was. Apparently, it was a substantial amount of money, and I think it was last in place in about 15 years ago or so.
Linda didn't have that.
Well, they can dig it up, but with this time that we had, it was kind of a...
Right, because she dug it up for me a couple of years ago.
Okay. But in any case, there hasn't been an ad valorem tax in many years, and there seems to be a lot of opposition to it, but because after we discussed it at our meeting, the Fork Union Sanitary District Advisory Committee adopted a motion recommending that the Board of Supervisors proceed with all dispatch to adopt the following rates for the Fork Union Sanitary District water system for fiscal year 2015. And that is basically option five.
What was the vote?
It was a 3-2 vote. I don't know the reasons why people voted that way, but it was a 3-2 vote of the five people that were present at the meeting.
And does
Does five represent all the voting members of the advisory board?
All the ones that are currently on the board, yes, sir. There are, I believe, two open positions right now. In any case, they are recommending a $21...
And that's without at-large taxes.
Yes, they failed to adopt any... They did not want to adopt a resolution regarding the ad valorem tax, so no action means they are recommending that one not be put in place.
I'm sorry, so option five is the only one that does not have an ad valorem tax?
Yes. This rate, this line right here, that's the ad valorem
tax. Right, the current ones obviously don't.
This is current rate, and then options 1 through 5, 5 cent, 3 cent, 2 cent, 1 cent, or no ad valorem tax, but of course adjusted rates to compensate for
it. Yep. So it becomes a use tax. What you use
is there any study on the impact of just charging for the 1,000 gallons right off the bat? Why the 3,000 gallons? What would be the impact of if you use 1,500 gallons?
No, you pay for 2,000.
You pay for 2,000.
Yes, you pay. If you don't use a drop of water that month, but you're connected to the system, you pay $17.76. So anything up to, I think that's correct. Anything up to the first 2,000 gallons is $17.76. Whether you use 50 gallons or you use 1,950 gallons, so everybody pays the basic rate, and then after that, it's based on volume.
And the average household uses.
Well, we're going to get to that in just a second.
Okay.
No, because we're going to show that they basically recommended what I called option five for purposes of that discussion, which would be a $21 minimum charge, which you would pay for 0 to 2,000 gallons of usage. If you use 2,001 gallons, well, rounding error is going to mean you probably still pay $21. But basically, once you use more than 2,000, it starts, you get gigged at a rate of $11 per 1,000 gallons. That particular rate structure takes away the reduction at 300,000 gallons. And I'll go ahead right up front and say that the largest customer on that system is the Fork Union Military Academy, and this will have a financial impact on them, which I
and that's
probably why we have this sitting here.
Mr. Stevens put together a breakdown of bills over the last year. Exactly the bills were for different buildings on Fork Union Military Academy under the current rate structure and the new proposed rate structure. And so the Air Force has that and knows what those dollar values would be. And that way I've asked them to be able to attend today to be able to address any concerns or.
Okay.
So the Admiral, after report, Admiral Berkhold can come to the mic.
I believe he would like to speak.
Ask questions.
Right.
Like
okay.
This is a chart I made that basically gives a certain number of usage, but monthly usage in the left column. The bill you would get for water under the current rates, your water bill under the proposed rates, and then the monthly increase. The 5,000 gallons is bold because that is right in there with the average household usage for a residential customer is right around 5,000 gallons a month. It's probably actually a little bit less on this water system, but I actually don't have enough data to really determine any kind of long-term averages.
Remember, this is water only, no sewage.
Right, more, so you're more... urban areas, I've seen averages as high as 7,500 gallons a month, but this area, I think people are pretty water conscious down in Fork Union, so you got lower averages to start with, and we don't actually have any outages, so there's no reason why they can't, but the bottom line is we're right around 5,000 as an average household use, so this proposed rate structure would result in about a $10.60, say $10 to $11 a month per customer. For your average residential.
What's the academy using?
The academy uses typically between 300 and 450,000 a month total. Now, the thing is, it's actually closer probably to 500,000 total, but it is spread among several different accounts. So they don't actually get up to 300,000 on any but two accounts. I think their main service typically runs around 400,000, and then their kitchen can run fairly high. So it is going to affect them. I think it came up. What did we say? It was going to be about six
$16,000 a year?
It's about $18,000
a year. Okay. It is going to result in about a $16,000 to $18,000 a year hit for the military academy at their current historical
but
usage.
But something's got to be done because we're digging a hole.
Well, yes, sir, and that's why I'm here. We need something does need to be done with the rates, the tax, what have you. But basically, the advisory committee recommended this rate structure. They did not recommend a tax, and
was that there's a reason for to vote.
Well, I'm not. I don't feel at liberty to speak for other people.
I'm trying to think. I know that they did not want to have tax. And then I think we have a new member on the board that may have
Mr. Johnson,
Mr. Finch,
Zink.
Zink,
Mr. Zink,
that may not have had all of the history and so forth. And I think he may have been one, and I don't know who the other
one was. I believe it was Mrs. Taylor.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Yes. Now, and I mean,
she would have. She's a long resident here.
And keep in mind, I have no
taxes raised. Period. She thought people would be able to. She wanted things to stay the way they are.
They couldn't afford extra taxes.
I think that's what she was saying. But I don't know if that's true.
Water.
Water.
Oh, it's different when it's water.
Yeah.
It's
Water. Yeah.
I mean, I would like to say from the standpoint of the structure of a sanitary district, particularly in this today, because sanitary districts were a kind of a thing from the 50s and 60s, and they helped get services, trash service, sewer service, water service to a lot of rural areas. But functionally today, the primary and main advantage of having a sanitary district is that additional taxing authority. Mm-hmm. There really isn't
right.
a lot more to be said from an operational, from the guy that's trying to operate a water system that's in a sanitary district and have it break even. You know, you're at best can only get short-term loans from the county coffers, the overall taxpayers, whereas, say, in some other area of the county is able to, of course, at the discretion of the board, use taxpayer funds to fund water and sewer improvements, tank constructions, things like that. That cannot be done in a sanitary district. Any money that they borrow from the county has to be paid back very quickly, which is what we're trying to do with this rate structure. So I guess maybe I don't know what I'm going to say. I'm just letting you know that it seems to me that if you are not going to use the taxing authority of the sanitary district, you should at least give consideration to phasing it out over some period of time,
so
and just taking it in as a county department.
As a new use tax, just charge.
Yes, sir, and in all honesty, the purpose of the main purpose for or is to have your water system break even. But I think if you look at the rate history, you can see that when I was going through that we went through almost a 20-year period where the rates didn't change at all.
Just about everything that we had,
and there's. You know, there's no possible way that
and the
costs associated with running that water system didn't go up in that 20-year period.
Yeah. So, your choice number five and the one they recommend will break me.
Over 20 years, I think you make 15,000. So that's a lot.
As you can see, in your years 1 through 5, you're still in a hole for a while, but then you build it back out. And, of course, again, this is a predictive model. This assumes usage patterns are going to stay the same. It assumes a very low, I think I assumed about 0.25% growth on the system.
Right.
Just very few people hooking up.
Now, if you did the tax, that would be military academies. They
don't pay the tax.
They don't pay the tax, so the rates,
yes.
But the rates would drop.
Yes, it would benefit military academy in two possible ways. One, that they're water bill would be lower, and they are not subject to the tax.
Right, which means the community.
Yes, sir.
So I understand why they.
Is the $500,000 we got allocated for repairs?
They did.
No.
Well, what is it?
Probably closer to double that. To bring the system up to truly up to snuff, so to speak. That if you had twice that, if you could put $1 million into that system, I think you could have a system that had sufficient capacity, sufficient storage, and a sufficient number of larger lines to provide fire flow and allow for development within that CPA. Because that Fort Keenan is a CPA, just as Zion Crossroads is, but the ability to bring in economic development in that area is stifled also by a lack of services. Now, sewer is something we haven't even started to talk about, and I hope we don't talk about it tonight because we could be here till 9 o'clock. But
what about the wells that at Thomasville?
Thomasville. In the hands of the owners now.
We had those tested.
We had them. Well, minimum tested. You know, you put a minimal amount of money into it, and it certainly appears that two of them have potential. I mean, the rest of them can be used as monitoring wells and such, but they certainly...
There's going to be some expense if we tie into those. That isn't even in these numbers.
Well, it is in that $500,000, because we would either do that or... to explore for another well. What I'm doing is the $500,000 is kind of a placeholder, if you will. There's a certain amount of money you're going to need to spend to get some additional source capacity for that water system, and we are exploring every single option that we can think of. Roger Smith and I have been researching these basically flatbed truck mounted drinking water treatment plants that can treat 50,000 gallons a day or so on a plant that can come in on a skid and be put in a building, hooked up and operated. That would be a surface water treatment plant. You could potentially put it in Bruno, use the existing water uptake that's already there, that was effectively, well, I won't say abandoned, not used since the 1970s. We could potentially look at, I don't think they're Tenasca anymore, but the Tenasca raw water line was originally designed with a certain amount of extra capacity, and it passes right through Bremo and right across the landfill property, as well as several within about 100 yards of one of our larger well lots. So we've been looking at the potential to tie a raw water line into that to avoid having to build a raw water line down to the river from there, and just kind of trying to balance all of that. And the Thomasville wells are one of those options. But no matter what you do, you're going to spend somewhere around $250,000 to $300,000 to get a reliable, say, an extra 50 to 100,000 gallons a day of water on there, and the rest of the money would be allocated for doing line upgrades and replacements.
That's why you brought that problem.
Well, you do a rate increase in 2010, and if you do another rate increase this year, so you're 4 years later, sometimes through this 20-year cycle, you're going to have to...
Yeah, I don't intend... That's the other thing. I don't intend for this to be the...
I guess the question is, the maintenance plans that you have put in place now, such that if, you know, the additional funding was there, you know, say you're laying pipe, as an example, you know, are we accounting for that, or are we going to come back and put in bigger pipes or ask for more money when we go through that? Has that kind of planning happened already?
No. However, that this ties back to our discussions regarding the Water and Sewer Master Plan, which I guess I should mention as an aside. The advisory committee did adopt one other motion that night, and that motion was as follows. This was a 5-0. It's basically a statement of support to the Board of Supervisors encouraging you to move forward with countywide master water and sewer planning, because those exact things that you just mentioned do need to be taken into account and accounted for. I've got a pretty good idea of some of the immediate projects that need to be done, and that's what we based the $500,000 on. But we will need more, and there will be other rate increases.
But $500,000 will allow us to bring another water source.
It should allow us to bring one water source and have some money left over for certain critical pipe improvements. It is certainly not the end-all, be-all solution for Fork Union, though.
Additional sort of increases in maintenance costs, are those these numbers are kind of related?
Yes, sir. If you, I guess I might be able to email it to you. I've got a spreadsheet model that,
I can pull up.
It uses basically a percentage of your construction cost as an annual operating, annual maintenance, and a replacement or renewal depreciation cost. So when you enter $500,000 as the number for the project that you're going to build, it uses, I think, 2% a year for maintenance, 2% for operating, and 1% or something for depreciation. And those numbers are changeable as well.
We currently don't set aside anything directly.
No. No, we do not. We actually don't do that on
pay the bills.
Anything. Buildings.
You're right about the wells. Does that include the well across the road from Carriesburg?
No, that's our well.
That's what I thought. That's our well.
That's just
that one, well, we had some...
That's all we can use it.
We are chipping away at that. I believe that thing's going to get pumped fairly soon, but our FUSD guys, they were down one man for quite a while, and then we had a very, very rough winter in the way of waterline breaks, freezing services, and having to do repairs. So we have not gotten to pumping that well yet.
Steve, would you explain to the board how we charge the academy now and the change that's in the... Why are they up?
Well, they're going to have a greater increase than others because, as you can see,
presently
any amount that you use
differently.
Well, right, any amount that you use over 300,000 gallons in a month is charged at the rate of $4.57 per 1,000 gallons. Mm-hmm. Up to 300,000, we're paying the $8.88. Mm-hmm. So, if you use 400,000 gallons, which virtually nobody except FUMA and occasionally the nursing home will do, then $100,000 of that is going to get charged at the $4.57 right now. Under the rate change, that 100,000 gallons would be charged at $11. Okay. And that is basically it's a 140% increase mm-hmm. in the rate for that usage category. Mm-hmm. And that is why their bill is going up at a significantly higher percentage than your average user.
You made a comment earlier that higher usage usually corresponds to
higher. That's what I've found to be typical in most water systems that I've been associated with. They actually have inclining rates, and for, say, residential customers, there's even
penalties.
Some systems that put in penalties for using ridiculously more than the average. Like if on a system the average is 7,000, if you're using 50,000 in a month,
right,
you would pay a very serious premium for that, for having, and that's based on the service size that you're using. Typically, FUMA would have a much larger service size, so they wouldn't pay that type of a penalty until a much higher usage rate. But that's getting into rate structures that we haven't even really considered for this system as of yet.
Yeah, no, that's another thing. Is this rate structure is really just a mimic of the structure that's there. The big, smallest structure that has been historical for fuzzy rate systems. All the new rates that are proposed in those five options mimic that. There's no change to kind of turn that around like it would be normally in other systems. That may be something we'll have to think about longer.
Yeah, at some point we'll have a work session on sort of the, if you will, the proper way to size service connections and to come up with a rate for a system.
Can we hear from Admiral Burkle?
First, I just want to know, does anybody have any more questions for me? Because I will certainly turn that.
I'd just like for him to, because I don't think he didn't have a representative there at that night.
We went and met with him
I know,
after that.
Yeah, right.
Thank you for the opportunity. I think actually what I say here might surprise you a little bit. I appreciate Steve and Wayne coming to visit me because it was very very helpful. But one of the reasons that it was a 3-2 vote is that our representative has not been there because I made him the dean of academics and he's too busy to go to those meetings now. Yeah. So it might have been 3-3, but I don't know that I would have wanted him to tie it up there. We're concerned because we're operating right now on the margin anyway, and actually spending about $3,000 or $4,000 more per cadet than we're bringing in revenue, and we're about to implement a campaign to help us make that up for scholarship money and help those things out. But I would also tell you, as I talked to Steve and as I've had these conversations over my last 3 years in there, we have to have water.
Yes.
For a school. And what I always want to do is be able to turn the tap on and have water come out of it and have all the young men that come there and all the families have it. And we certainly understand that we need to pay our fair share. And I think one of the reasons about these rates and using more, you have to compare similar users, and I think we're the only user that's using that much, so it wouldn't seem anywhere near fair to charge us more per 1,000 gallons than less. My suspicion is part of the reason for those rates is, at least what people tell me around the school, is that FUSD started by a well that was given by Fort Kenyon Military Academy way back, and so we were the original folks that were helping out in creating the system anyway. So the only thing I would tell you is that if this means that we're going to have reliable water and that we're not going to have to worry about this again, then we certainly are supportive of the increase, even though it's going to be something that we're going to have to really work hard to make up. Yeah. But certainly appreciate and understand the issues within Savannah County. But I also point out, even though we're not paying taxes, we do have a $13 million budget for the school, and we're paying people in and associated with the school about $6 million. And so I think we're bringing a substantial amount of income into the county, and certainly with bringing in 300 and 400 alumni this weekend, as well as the students and the parents. But something unrelated to water, just a little, as I was sitting waiting for my opportunity to come up, you should know that last weekend, our sprint medley track team that ran, it's a 200-meter, 200-meter, 400-meter, 800-meter, ran the fastest time in the state of Virginia and the fourth fastest time in the nation. So
wow.
So good for Savannah County, too. And the good news is re-enrollment and admissions, all those things are up, so we're looking forward to a great 2014-15, and maybe we'll have enough cadets to be able to pay the water bill.
And I know that, you know, because we were worried about the water when the new dorm came, but then you all have such a better efficiency of the water use and all that that you said you weren't going to use more.
Well, I think Jacobson's using less. It's actually saving us. We're saving on utilities now a little bit because it's geothermal,
right.
and making some efficiencies, and we've got some things that are going that we'll try and save on the margins. And certainly this will give us a greater incentive to conserve water as well, which will be our next initiative as we start the year. But I appreciate your concern. Appreciate the concern of the board and inviting me to come up and speak.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Quick. I don't mean to know if it's in the restrooms, but I know in high usage places,
you
know, there's
non-flush. Yeah. Yeah, part of our challenge right now is having the money to invest in infrastructure. I have a donor who unfortunately just passed away, but just before he was passed away, knowing that he was at the edge there at the end, he's provided us an amount of money to help us take a particular building off the central boiler. And so by investing $300,000 in this, in our dining facility, it'll allow us to save about $100,000 a year. And I would agree with you. That will eventually, after 3 years, pay for itself and help us with things like this. But that's exactly what we need to do because we have such aging infrastructure, is invest up front to be able to save a little bit later. And that's the kind of thing that we'll start looking at.
Okay, thank
you. But again,
you.
I appreciate that.
Yes. All right, so we've heard the report from Wayne, and you know, this is just a beginning. I mean, it's probably just a Band-Aid, but we're working very hard, and I appreciate what Mr. Stevens has been doing. I tell you, he and Roger and and Willis Thomason. They have been researching and looking at everything, and we know that we're going to have to do something more. And I want us to keep this. We have to get Fort Union straight some way or the other. As Don always say, this has been a problem for many years, and we're tackling it now. And we're going to have to do something. About 400 and some homes using
the water. It's about 400 residential connections and another 30 to 40 commercial or non-residential.
So,
but I would hope that the board would give direction tonight, because we really don't want to wait too long. And we need to probably move fairly quickly to get back to you with a formal recommendation and formal motions to adopt, because you'd want to put the rates into effect sometime coming up.
But you don't want a formal adoption, huh?
No, sir. In fact, we'll come back next year. This is a presentation tonight, and we want to take input, have discussion, get some direction, as Mr. Nichols said, and then I would see us coming back at the next meeting with a formal motion to begin the procedures for a rate change.
I'm not surprised with Fort Union Military Academy's stand. I expect us to hear that because it's fair, and I didn't expect to ever hear anything except fair. So, with the and the answer to the 3-2 vote is satisfying to me. So, I mean, I certainly would go with the recommendation since it's not. It's not our water system. So,
I can tell you, it's not put it on the next agenda.
I would think option five.
I can tell you that the staff would have recommended two or three.
Mm-hmm.
Option two or three.
Right.
But there was a 3-2 vote.
Absolutely. Yeah. We've been very effective to you.
So, what would be the staff's recommendation on option two or
these.
Right. But what was the reasoning?
That was including the tax,
because it moderates the rates somewhat and applies tax to the only advantage you have to having a sanitary district tax on
it. So about 50% of the properties that lie within the service district are connected to the water system. Now, admittedly, not all of them can connect, but the purpose of defining the sanitary district with a boundary was to have an area where the people within that district would benefit from whatever services are provided. In this case, the sanitary districts can provide any number of services, but in this case, they decided to do a water system. A fairly strong argument can be made that everybody who is in that district benefits from having a water system there, particularly because one thing that this system does have is better than adequate storage, and you get improved homeowners insurance rates for having a house even near a water system, near with a hydrant. I mean, for instance, I can't remember who it was I was talking to, but somebody I was talking to is not on the system. They're outside the district, but they're about 50 feet from the terminus of our system on a hydrant, and they get a bonus or a discount on their insurance rates. There is not, obviously, a truly definite, tangible benefit, but this is going to get into the philosophical thing about planning, because people that want to live in the rural part of the county benefit from having CPAs where people are more densely developed, so therefore they benefit from having a water system because they don't have a bunch of sprawled out. My thoughts were that you spread the pain a little bit. There's a lot larger base, if you will, of property owners in the who are in the district than there are customers on the system. Keeping in mind that what we were talking about was either a 2 or 3 cent tax. I think the last ad valorem tax was something on the order of 30% of the actual real estate tax rate at that time. That's the number that I'd heard bandied about by people. So it was relatively high. If the tax rate was, say, 30 cents, then it meant that the ad valorem tax would have been 10. What we would be proposing here would be either 2 or 3 cents. I think the new tax rate's 88.
88?
Yep, I should know that. I'm going to be paying it soon. So a 2 cent is nowhere near as high a tax relative to your real estate values as it was the last time this was done. And it really, as you can see, it doesn't hit it that much. You're talking about the difference between, say, 20 and then 10 and 10 versus 21, 11 and 11. And you get roughly the same result over the 20-year period.
How many gallons go through the pipeline total?
I think we're using about 175,000 a day, which is going to be about 40 million a month, something like that.
See, the only part about that tax I don't like is...
I'm sorry, 4 million a month.
I don't like taxing people for something they don't use.
You're using 30%.
And then if you back this whole thing up, and what troubles me about it is, you can't go back in history, but those 14 folks are going to be paying, already going to be paying taxes an hour on this tax bill on Zion's Crossroads water that has nothing to do with them. And now you want to tax them another 2 cents water that has something to do with them. And some of those people aren't using it. So now they're paying essentially 5 cents if you did that on water they, between Zion's and Fort Union, they have nothing to do with it.
Yes, sir. The lake's doing the same thing.
That's the unfair part. And if you go with what you just pay for what you use, and that pays for the system. That's fair.
No, there's certainly, that is certainly a valid argument.
That doesn't hurt the guy that has a well in a septic tank, and that's what he wants, and he'll pay the thousands of dollars in loans next month, because that's what he wants.
And the other way to look at it, that's why I asked how much per month, and I'm not trying to, we talked about fair. If you go with the tax, roughly fourth to a third of it is used by FEMA, and then they wouldn't be participating in the tax.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
I mean, anyway. And I'm not trying to be unfair to anyone. That's just being even to all.
Okay. And that also is an excellent point. I mean, our sanitary district is, well, everything's unique, but we have a small customer base, and we have this extremely large customer who is tax exempt, so it kind of does make an argument against putting in a tax. I mean, at this point in time, I'm perfectly comfortable. Well, I'm going to be paying those water rates, but I'm perfectly comfortable with option 5 as a staff recommendation.
Just put
that. That was what
the advisory board's recommendation.
Right.
The advisory board put in place to do that. If to the advisory board, we would have recommended, Mr. Stevens did, advocated for 2 and 3. The advisory board, though, has voted for
the
option 5.
The argument against?
Yes, clearly.
Does it make sense to you, or am I just...
Well, both sides make complete sense to me.
Yes, sir. And that's why I'm perfectly comfortable with option 5, given that we discussed it at length at that committee meeting, and the advisory committee, their advice was to go with option 5, and I absolutely don't have a problem with that. No, sir.
Right. But I think that they need some directions on what should they... They're working on many things, and he's talked about the Carisbrook well. Talked about the ECTI coming through, talking about revitalizing the James River input and purifying the water. I mean, there are $500,000 to look for another well and to update what we already have. So we have some things that we need to tell staff what we want them to do. Do we want them to continue working on all of those things? Do we want them to come back with some more costs?
Well, there is
or some more.
This is for
But we're still the board.
It's got nothing to do with staff.
Yes, but it does.
It's got nothing to do with staff.
After Mr. Allmutter, it does, because there's no one else to do it. Staff has to do it.
Yeah. That it does. And
there is no one else to do it.
And
it's staff.
Attorney. Would you tell us what our obligations are to a sanitary district?
I'm not sure I understand you.
Center to a, are we just out of the whole picture? The board has nothing to do. We're still the governing board.
The board is the governing body of the, right. of the sanitary district.
Right.
Understand one thing, and this is way beyond the scope of this discussion, but I don't want you to lose sight of the long term of this, and that is that Mr. Stevens brought up a point that in a lot of ways, from a lot of perspectives, the concept of a sanitary district is obsolescent. It came up in a time when counties had very limited authority. And you couldn't have a county water system. The county didn't have the authority to do that. So this allowed the county to do it. And it specifically was intended to be self-supporting.
Mm-hmm.
So the county didn't have to pay anything for it. Now, the problem with that from the perspective that we have is that FUMA is not self-supporting, or excuse me, FUSD is not self-supporting.
Mm-hmm.
And the county has very limited ability to subsidize FUSD. So you couldn't say, well, we want to rescue FUSD and make it put it on a paying basis, so we're going to appropriate $1 million to do the necessary improvements. You have very limited ability to do something like that. The upshot of that is that for the long term, I think you're going to hear doubts expressed about the continued viability of FUSD as a sanitary district.
Yes.
Now, there are other, I'm not saying their system goes away, but their system isn't a separate district. Remember, FUSD is a special taxing district of the county. It is not a separate entity. It's not like a service authority. It's not like a public service company. It's a special taxing district of the county. That's why you members of the board, are its governing body.
It's his water department, in brief terms, because he's the public works director.
Sure.
It's just one of our staff functions. There are special authorities with it, as Mr. Payne complained, but it's just one of our staff functions.
And the other thing is, as a sanitary district, we have ways we can dissolve it, but we can't because we have debt. We owe $600,000+.
We cannot do that.
Now we can sell it.
Well, as well as
sell.
Are you saying we as FUSD?
Yes.
Not we.
We.
You can correct me if I'm wrong, but the county does own that water system, correct?
The water system belongs to the county because
listen.
The water system belongs to the county because the sanitary district is merely a taxing district of the county.
Right. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We don't own the water facility.
Yes, sir. The county owns the property on which the water facility. There's nothing down there that is in the name of the Fort Union Sanitary District.
So the county can sell it. This board can sell it.
You can sell it, and if the governing body, the county, is willing to accept, take over the debt of a sanitary district, then they can dissolve it. If it has standing debt.
It's about
$600,000.
$600,000,
right.
And we pay $68,000.
That's about
the loan. Right. A loan to do the Morris well.
Sure. And the argument leaning that way is if you're not going to use the special taxing district authority and you're just going to charge on a per usage basis, then some could argue or would argue saying that, well, what's the difference between that and Zion Crossroads? What you're trying to do is you're trying to concentrate growth into your CPAs. And if and kind of the rising tide floats all boats, if the CPA is a good thing for the county and we concentrate development in Zion Crossroads, it keeps our other areas rural, but everybody in the county helps pay for that system.
You see, this is something that we heard about this 3 months ago and addressed it in a different direction as to what's the county taking over and spreading the pain across the county.
Mm-hmm.
Not across the district, the sanitary district. You follow me here?
Mm-hmm. Sure, but this is clearly not the first time we brought this exact discussion up.
I'm just saying to you that if
it's a little way not. I mean, you're a year away from it being up. Do something like that. But then we're talking in the world of fair, and we're talking about bringing water at Simon's Crossroads and all over the county.
But you're already spreading the pain.
The pain is 68,000.
You're already spreading the pain. If there's $68,000 in debt financing that the county is paying,
no, 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 no. The county's not paying that. Fuzzy's paying out of those rate structure. Understand the difference.
If we dug them up, that's almost 3 cents.
Mr. Ellenberg's talking about fairness and spreading the
across the
burden and things like that. If you were to establish, and I'm making this up, if you were to establish a public works department to provide water to Zion Crossroads, and it was not self-supporting, the county could simply subsidize that. Mm-hmm. And if it did, I can tell you who would be paying, and that is the general taxpayer. Mm-hmm. So the person at Fork Union or Columbia or Hell's Bend or Kent Store or whatever it would be paying to help subsidize that. That's the difference with the sanitary district. The sanitary district is specifically designed to prevent Kent Store taxpayer from having to subsidize Fork Union. Mm-hmm. That's the difference. Now, I will tell you that there's another thing called the service district. It's one of those patches that the General Assembly puts on once every 10 years or something. And this was 10 years or 40 years after the sanitary district patch. It allows you to do some things somewhat like a sanitary district. It's not the same, but it does allow you to have mandatory hookups and make assessments and things like that. And it's likely that, well, obviously it's likely, but it's possible that you could do something like that for Zion Crossroads. One of the things that was in the proposal for Aqua was the creation of service districts. And that was for specifically that purpose, to ensure the ratepayer base. Now, one of the things we need to talk about this some more, but one of the things I think you could do is put a minimum charge on anybody having frontage on this system. So if you like your well and you want to keep it, you can keep it, but you're going to pay a minimum charge to Fuzzy to operate the system.
Because you have the opportunity.
Because you have the opportunity. And that's, I'm not going to tell you whether that's fair or not. I can tell you that there would be an argument that it is fair, because it provides you the opportunity. The fact that the system is there provides you the opportunity to hook up if you choose to do so, either for development purposes or you want your well dries up or whatever. So that's another option that you may very well have. And again, that's not a tax.
And that's really the kind of the whole basic argument about taxes in general. Anyway, general taxes. I mean, I don't have any children in school. I haven't had children in school in years.
Right.
But I contribute to the general welfare because it's part of our tax structure. Mm-hmm. So a public water system, while it may not serve me directly because I may not be on that public water system, serves the general good of our county because it concentrates things we want in certain areas. And
what's
so,
the section?
Right.
Pardon? It's a section of it.
Now, the problem, but it affects the tax base for the entire county because of revenues.
Right.
The problem with doing that at this point,
if you're bringing business in,
where's that problem playing for King? That argument doesn't wash.
Well, the problem with the minimum charge that I just mentioned in this case is, what are you going to do when all those people that get added on with the minimum charge say, okay, I'll hook up, then you're having to work.
Mm-hmm.
Are they required to hook up if they're well fenced?
They're not now. I'm not saying they're required. I'm saying
they're
not required now specifically if they have a viable well.
All right. So what?
However, if their well fails, I have to double check the county ordinance. There's an ordinance section, a chapter in the ordinance that deals with Fuzzy, and I believe if you're within a certain number of feet, and it might be 500 of the water system, and your well fails, you are connected.
And it would be cheaper for them to
It's not really necessary to enforce it very often because there aren't that many failing wells down there.
Right. So we still need to think about what we want. Where do we want to go with this? Do we want them to continue working on what they're working on? No, I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about the option five.
Well, that's the
right.
We need to know what you want to come back to for a case.
Right.
I actually would maybe like to have a work session on this sometime soon to get more direction on exactly what you're talking about right now, Mrs. Booker, which is the multiple things that we're looking at and maybe where we should concentrate. Sure. But I think the important thing right now is we need to recognize that the rates need to change. That can happen independently of choosing the specific projects because we put some placeholder amounts of
so this
debt load in this thing.
It
boils
down to, is there any momentum on the board side to sell the system? If there really isn't,
I know Arthur would love with that.
You could put out a bid to see if somebody wants to.
Sure.
I don't know that.
Yeah.
Well, you're not gonna save the rate payers a penny on that. So I mean, I don't know. No, I can promise you that anyone you sold it to is in it for a profit, not a wash, but even to lose them.
That would be up to the business, Bob, whether they wanted to buy it or not, or see a future to it.
I understand that, but if we start looking at Fort Bend County and a water system, we've got Columbia over here on Ottawa, right?
Yeah.
We've got Lake Monticello over here on Ottawa. Now we've got Fort Union on Fuston, right? And then we've got Science Crossroads I've never seen a county like this in my entire life. It's a hodgepodge, and not one of these single things was a plan. Not one of them was a plan.
Oh yes,
there is no plan. It's a nothing that connects.
Has to be a plan.
Well, where was the plan most?
That's not quite fair, Mr. Albert. The reason it's not is because this is a historical development.
Yes.
And Columbia, Aqua runs Columbia's system.
That's correct.
Columbia founded that as a municipal water system.
That's correct.
And so when that was done, there wasn't any need for a public water system outside the town of Columbia. That's why you had the town.
Mm-hmm.
And with Fork Union, you had, it's not a municipality, but it's a settled area, if you will. And that was where the need was.
With a lot more business back then than now.
Now, Lake Monticello is its own, but it's the same kind of phenomenon. It's a densely populated area.
Mm-hmm.
But what's happening and you may lack some of the historical perspective of somebody like Mrs. Booker or Mr. Weaver would have,
right,
that they traditionally, if you take 60 years ago, Atlanta County's population density outside settled areas, let's call it Palmyra, Fork Union, Columbia, Scottsville, outside of those places, it was so low that there was not only no authority for the county to operate a water system, there wasn't any need for it. And it would have been absolutely prohibitively expensive to try to do it because the density was so low. And
still low in many areas.
It is indeed, but it's less.
This type of situation is actually not unique at all. When I first went to work for Falkirk County, they had 18 independent freestanding water systems. Through consolidation, interconnection, and slow growth in between different growth areas, I think they've reduced that number down to 12 now. But Loudoun County, I believe, at one time had about 10 freestanding public water systems, which are, with the growth rate they had in the late 90s, they're pretty much all one now. But
so
my only concern is that we got to keep the water running.
So this is to keep the water running,
right.
the rate option five.
Mm-hmm.
A whole separate discussion is what do we want to do in the bigger long-term picture. Largely, that will be answered by the master water and sewer plan. Mm-hmm. When the analysis is done by a consultant to come in and look at all our systems, it will include those things in it, too.
That will answer your point, Mr. Holmberg.
Time has come to do what you said.
I guess guess the real question is,
and we're just about it. I mean, we passed the hour, dinner time, and
I guess we wanted to know, is it the consensus of the board that you'd like to see a resolution relating to adopting a rate that accords with option 5 at the next meeting? All right, you'll see it.
Break out some of those banded years and say, you know, projected rate increase for those banded years.
I can, now that I know which option we're going to lean towards, I'll start doing a little more year-to-year tweaking within it to see what we can do.
Thank you.
Mr. Lester, do we want to make him stay until after dinner? Do we want to let him go now?
We have...
just come back to that.
We have radon.
Tomorrow, actually.
We'll come back on May 21st with option 5 late case, but with some other additional information with it.
I will try that.
The whole different story is the master water and sewer plan. We'll talk about the cottage systems, upgrade systems, and
Mr. O'Brien, I'll try to have some kind of rough sort of outlook guesses as to when we might need
this next board meeting. You know, we got to vote on this then. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's what I thought.
Yeah, and now can we finish up the presentations so we have Ms. Cheryl to do the radon ordinance review and Mr. Darius Lester.
No, we'll vote. This is a presentation.
Presentation. It's not an action item. Okay.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the board. We do want to give you an update on what we've been doing about radon in Fluvanna. You've seen some of the figures from before, but there were 128 tests that had been done between 86 and 2013 with an average level of 3.4 picocuries per liter. And we, through a variety of ways with the 125 kits that BDH gave us, we have distributed a number of them, and the most recent numbers back, we've had 54 tests come back. We had collected 70, but there were 16 that were invalid for a variety of reasons, like not sealed properly or exposed too long, that kind of thing. But there were 54 kits that were adequately processed. And of that, the bottom line is that the average was a 2.298 average of those kits, which is actually down from the 3.4 picocuries per liter, which is, I thought those rates might be going up a little bit because we've had some concern with the earthquake disturbing the ground and whether that would have an effect on that, but overall it looks like it's the numbers are down. There were a number of cases, about 18%, about 10 of those cases that were over the 4.0 level, which the EPA recommends having some kind of mitigation to it. And I've listed four of those top four on the top 10 there on that side there that listed the highest levels. The Gordonsville one, I know that's not in Fluvanna, but we had a number of faculty members from the high school that did it. So that was one of the ones that came up high there.
11.1 is off the charts.
Yeah.
So it would make me want to retest that one, but it may be. You know, you just don't know.
Yeah. And of those two, there were 10 cases that came back. The levels were under 0.3 picocuries. So it's almost not even just
now
a trace.
Now the EPA is about to change to the 3.0, which is the European
level. And even that, our average would be under that, too, which is just interesting. Oops, I'm sorry. What we've been doing, we have this at the educational brochure, which you've seen, and it's available in a variety of places, events, website. It's also available down in building inspections office, newspapers online, informational community meetings. And I've met in the last month with a chemistry class at the high school, and we've given out about 60 tests to students and faculty. They're doing it as a project. And then in September, Lake Monticello will do a story on their cable channel, and we'll distribute kits through the office then too. And there may be, I think in the fall, there may be some additional kits available. So how does this, how does what we're doing and what our ordinances are, how does that stack up to what's being done in the rest of the world, or at least in the U.S.? Here's a little bit from the EPA's website of who has what. And we're down under the, we have statewide radon-resistant new construction codes, but the local jurisdictions have to adopt them. They're not a mandatory setting. And Darius is going to speak to us now a little bit more on what we have. Move this one to advance.
The top two blocks that you're looking at there are the enabling legislation, which gives authority for localities in Virginia to adopt Appendix F, which is a portion of the Virginia Residential Code that deals with radon-resistant construction. You'll see that there are three listed up there, three localities that have already adopted Appendix F, Rockbridge County, Shenandoah County, and the city of Blacksburg, and I believe Buckingham County has adopted it as well. The provisions of Appendix F, it's basically the code. It's the provisions that one would take to mitigate radon in new construction. And homes with ventilated crawl spaces are exempt from the code. Virginia code gives localities authority to enforce locally adopted, if it's locally adopted. And we saw that from the previous slide. Recommendations for Fluvanna County. Continue with community education. Continue to provide home testing kits as they're available through the health department. And provide radon information brochures and make Appendix F available for new construction applicants as requested. At this time, staff does not recommend any changes to county ordinances or the code.
Is there a reason for that, Matt Paul?
Well, there are a couple. I guess the biggest one is that if we make a countywide code,
which is the state code. It's not a countywide code.
Well, if we adopted it, it would be countywide. Right.
The state code.
Right. It would be the state code. We're making all new home applicants that don't have a ventilated crawl space put in mitigation measures that may or may not be needed. And with what we're seeing right now, it's going down, and most likely it's not needed. For those that need it, they're going to wish they had it in there. We do encourage people to do it and certainly consider doing it as they apply for the a building permit. But we have yet to really see a need to enforce, you know, make them hold them to the fire.
Well,
fire and make them do
it's
it.
It's a lot cheaper to put it in pre-construction.
It's somewhat cheaper, yes.
I mean, we heard that. Well, it's 2 months ago.
Yeah, it's cheap on this. Yeah. It's a whole lot of pros and cons to it.
Well, to save a life is a lot more pros and cons. The opportunity to save a life.
Yeah, I don't know where the information. Well, it came. You have to be exposed to it for quite some time. Cheryl would know that better.
It's figured over a 70-year lifespan, as we discussed before, and it's the continuous exposure to it over a 70-year lifespan. And what we found, too, is the ventilation is the best mitigation, and that's why ventilated crawl spaces are exempt, because the radon can come up through there and then just goes out to the air. And so the mitigation would simply be adding ventilation.
Right.
And I know Mr. Lester talked with a gentleman just the other day about what the difference of costs are, and he said it really depends on aesthetics and of whether you your aesthetics costs can rate and have the difference between how you do mitigate after construction.
I've done a large study, and that 70-year thing is all over the map, and that there's no real scientific, because it's a really new science, that the radon exposure is 40 years old, as far as the science of it goes. So it's like 20 years ago they were feeding football players salt tablets, you know, and now it's the worst thing you can do. So to say that, you know, you can suck in radon and breathe it in for 70 years and you'll finally get cancer, I don't like rolling the dice like that. And knowing it's a danger is enough for me to say go to the biggest precautions you can do. And the state adopted a code, and like everything else the state does, they left it to the counties to pick up the pieces and carry through with what they didn't have the strength to do, which was to adopt the code and make it mandatory. So they adopted the code for a reason, because they had these arguments 7 years back, and then they dropped the ball and passed it on to the counties. And I just think it, my conscience, I don't want to leave something like this saying, going on a lack of science and not going with the strongest precautions necessary. I mean, we're only talking $1,000 on the new construction. putting the pipe in the ground, it's a simple thing. It takes about an hour. It's not something that's a major part of the construction. And they don't have to go through closets and everything. It's pre-done, and it's in the design. And it's not rocket science for these home builders. They know what they're doing. They have to do it in some locations. So it's not a big deal. That $1,000 is just part of doing business, but it's part of saving a life down the road. So I don't know why there's even an argument here. And to take the rounded out number of 2.8 for the county, and that's like median household value. I mean, it really doesn't mean anything, because you're getting high-end numbers in some sections of the county and low-end numbers in other sections of the county, depending on where you're at. And to come out with a 2.8 number is saying, oh, I don't have to worry about it when it gets printed in the Food Banner Review next week.
Well,
but let me finish. But it is a real problem in certain areas of the county. So it's not fair to take that 2.8 number, average it out, and make your decisions on whether to go with the state code or follow through with the ordinance, because it takes a few extra inspections.
Mr. Allenbeck, okay. It's 2.3, and staff is not making a decision. We're just making a recommendation. Whichever way the board wants to do it.
You can take an average, right. And average is
2.3.
Statistically significant.
Yeah.
Right, you need 50.
I agree. 64.
You need at least 50 to even be statistically
significant.
I think the beginning of my question was the decision due to manpower? Because when I read this,
they're not making a decision. We will make the decision.
The recommendation is written right here.
Right. They made the recommendation.
Due to manpower.
And what we have to do
is... Because it said it would take more inspections.
What we have to do is talk about it. We decide whether we want to adopt it. So, I mean, and that's the truth. I mean, it's
not a shame. You're going to be quiet tonight?
No, you're fine.
No, you're not.
Yeah. That's the tale. It's 6:18, and I appreciate the report from them, and they've given us recommendations. You have a question.
Simple question. You mentioned that we heard that the preventative measure to be taken for radon. How is that being encouraged right now in the building permit process?
We have the appendix F right there. It's available to them, and the brochure right there on the counter. They can't miss it.
And so the appendix F says essentially
that gives them.
That's the statement.
Correct.
Statement saying. Well,
it actually has drawings for how to do it.
Okay.
Those are in the house.
If you're an individual, those are
okay.
All house.
That seems to be.
But if you're a builder building 400 houses, you may have to be intentional to have one thing.
Okay, so we have heard the recommendations from and we need to our discussion is whether we want to adopt state code. I'd have to
well,
see
we're not
what
doing
the
that
no, this is just a presentation.
We need direction for you on if
right.
You want to come back with a formal.
We need
formal,
to look at the.
Oh, we will.
Personally, I'd like to see us adopt the state code to go on.
How many
on the side of safety?
Okay.
How many others would like to have the state code adopted on the board? Anybody feel like Mr. Oliver?
I'm comfortable with the staff's recommendations right now.
Okay.
I mean, I think it's certainly, if, as they continue to put out more tests, and if those numbers show changes and the code changes to 3.0 and some of the signs change, I'm comfortable if we make it clear in the building permit process. That's a good starting point for our county.
Okay. Mr. Weaver, what do you think?
I accept the recommendations, and I think it's just more bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. There's no end to bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. Look at the state and federal government. You keep on going and adding more. Your life is controlled by everything you do. And if somebody wants to do that, they can go ahead and do it. You know, so I'm not going to put any more burden. And you say, well, it's only $1,000. Well, $1,000 is $1,000.
It's a new construction.
Right. Yeah, I know it is, but it's still $1,000 that adds to the cost. But I don't think we need it now.
Right.
What's canceled?
Okay, Mr. Sheridan. Ms. Sheridan.
I agree with Mr. Weaver.
Okay. And I do too. I agree with. We accept the recommendation. You all have done a lot of work, and you've got things in place. And I would just appreciate it to stay the way
yeah.
It is.
I appreciate it.
I do too. Yeah. And because he did that, we're at the point that we have done something. And so, yeah.
Because there's still nobody testing in Kinstone.
Right. And so we can get more tests.
One in North Anna.
And they can come back, and you all can come back later and give us an update. All right. Let's go to the consent agenda, please. Anyone would like to pull anything from the consent agenda?
I have two.
Okay, which one?
Q and R. And they're just a quick question.
Okay.
And I was going to do a few questions, Councilor. But I can close this down, go up to accounts payable. They're not critical.
Accounts payable. That's the first one is up.
The line items, Mr. Weaver?
I was going to go ahead and skip it. We're short on time.
And I just said,
if you have questions afterwards, just let us know the numbers and we'll check them for you. Okay, we'll do that later then.
Okay, so
okay.
We won't take up time to check the runs.
And one question on Q&R, are there any, on those two grants, are we contributing?
There's no match.
100%.
That's one question.
Okay. All right, may I have a motion on the consent agenda, please?
So made.
Okay, second. I move the motion by Mr. Weaver, second by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor? That includes public hearing minutes of April the 9th, minutes of April the 16th, accounts payable report, proclamation, Virginia Cooperative Extension Day, fiscal year 14, Fluvanna County Public School Federal School Improvement Grant, and fiscal year 14 local emergency management performance grant. All right, all in favor? Did I say that? Aye. Okay, chair votes aye, so that's 5-0. Do we have any unfinished business? Anything unfinished? Any new business? Now we have our second public hearing. If you would like to speak to the board, please come to the mic and give your name, address, and you have 5 minutes. Close the second public hearing.
I was Kenny
be patient.
No, that's good.
Okay. All right.
She's hungry.
Ma'am, when do we do
the
vote?
Probably do it after your work session.
Yeah.
All right. So.
Just like to get Mr. Hessler and share.
Yeah, we did.
We do.
Yeah.
You missed that.
All right, so now we will have our recess, and we'll be back at 7.
Dinner's in the Morris Room.
Okay.
Are we recess?
Yeah. Okay, recess. And the first thing with our work session is alternative revenue sources and options by Mr. Dahl, our County Director of Finance.
And it'll probably be Mr. Nichols, but I'll call Mr. Dahl up.
All right.
I put his name on, so if there's anything wrong with it, you could blame him. Mm-hmm. And honestly, he's done a lot of this work on it, but he's been busy because they're short staffed in the department, so I'll do most of the lead on him. I do want to acknowledge the group from the Flu Valley Leadership Development Program, Mr. O'Brien, Mr. Shane, Mr. Sadler, and Ms. Clausen, mm-hmm. were a group in the most recent Savannah Leadership Development class that worked on this topic. And the staff provided some information for them. So we selectively pulled things back out of their brief, and as well as the existing brief that we had, to put together this information for tonight. But if there are any specific technical details that their presentation or additional topics you want to talk about, the three of them are here tonight, along with Mr. O'Brien, and so we can certainly tap them as resources as well. So let me just give you a reminder. Remember, we back in January we talked about this issue. The likelihood was that any of these things that you may change, any revenue streams you may tap onto, any additional sources of revenue you may look for, may not have any impact during fiscal year 15. It may require referendums, it may require state approval, it may require significant marketing campaigns. There's a whole variety of things depending on what we potentially take aim at. We'll give you some recommendations here at the end of tonight, but just remember, this is not an immediate revenue stream we're trying to find out. We're trying to find a way to really work on this. Mm-hmm. That 93.7 tax base that we've got, sometime over the coming years, we would like to modify that tax base so it's not so home-based and not as much business-based, but spread out our tax base so that it affects, you know, all aspects of our county in a little different way. If you do business development, you might be able to change and have a little more business tax base. If you change some of your taxes to different kind, you don't necessarily have to just increase taxes. You can add a tax and decrease another one so that it impacts citizens and businesses in a different way too. This is not necessarily just adding to the stack. This may be restacking what you have or the types of revenue you have coming in. If it ends up being revenue neutral, that doesn't necessarily help from a county revenue point of view, but it may help from a business or a citizen point of view. So we look at all those alternatives. So when we look at our revenues, you know, we are predominantly real estate and personal property now, but you really have to look at all these. What are investments? What money are we getting for our investments of the county's money? What do we have for taxes in various ways? Service charges, the permits and fees, impact fees or proffers, cash proffers that we have from developers, or any special assessments. You talked about a special taxing district tonight was a way to help solve FSD's money problems within that district, but it doesn't help the county writ large. But we have to look at all these potential areas. The sources of local government taxes now come from largely these group of things. Now, there are other subcategories of these or other categories like cash proffers and certain types of fees that aren't truly in the tax revenue kind of column. But when you look at tax revenues from the state, this is where it largely comes from. Counties, this is the number of counties that have those tax items in place. These are the number of cities that have those in place. This is the amount of tax collected each year for those various things, and the percentage. And obviously, real property is the largest one out of that. It's certainly the largest in our county, but it's the largest in most places throughout the Commonwealth. The ones that we have in place currently are the highlighted blue ones. Those are ones that are currently used by Fluvanna County. So we have a real property tax rate and personal and business property and local sales and use taxes, public service corporation property tax. We have those in place already, but there's a number of ones that aren't highlighted there that we don't have in place that we'll look at. So in doing some comparisons, what we did is pulled out of the Weldon Cooper source books and the state source books for comparative reports on revenues and on tax rates. So most of what you're going to see tonight is based on 2013 revenues and 2013 tax rates. But this
this state map shows where we pulled comparables from, and I'm going to go to a map right after this. It makes it a little easier to see where these are at. That one. So you can see the triangle areas, they're not, maybe not even near us. Some are around us in the center and northern part of Virginia, but a lot of them are in southwestern Virginia. It's because they're very similar in size. And then all the blue ones are because they're just right around us. They're the ones we compare to, they're the ones we compete with. And then Albemarle, I put just highlighted in gray, I don't include them, Albemarle, in the average calculations because they're really not typical to us. They have a much different tax structure in a 100,000 population, whereas we're at 26,000. So these are the counties, the localities that we compared against to when we did these tax rate comparisons and revenue comparisons. So on your desk there, for anyone in the audience, there's copies of these sheets out on the front there, the large spreadsheet is what we're looking at now. I know that you have to have glasses to read it, but there's a lot of information on there. But what I tried to do is make sure that we can pull off this sheet pretty much anything we wanted. So for instance, let's look at population on line line four on your sheet. So the population shows that the lowest population in the group was 10,000. That's Cumberland County. We don't really compare to Cumberland County very much, but because they're touching our county, they're really one of the five immediately adjacent, we include them. And the highest, 33,707, I believe, is Louisa. If you go out a little farther, what's the average size? Again, less Albemarle. Albemarle's figures are in the very last column, the gray column, but we did not include those in the averages. Then you'll see Fluvanna's figures. And then if you go out, you'll see these blue columns and then the orange columns. That equates to the same thing you just saw on that map. The blues are the ones that are adjacent to us, right around our central Virginia area. And the oranges are ones that are similar in size but different localities within the state. And so I wanted to find localities that had at least similar population to see what, if their tax base, what they bring in, and what types of taxes they have in place. And then you can go down through this long list. The red lines, or the kind of pinkish lines on the screen there, are the tax rate lines, and the green lines are the revenue lines. And then there's personal property, and then machinery and tools, and merchant's capital, different things like that. Now, on your sheet, there are a number of items that are standing out in red. So,
now,
for instance,
who is the 42 cent? Is that Buckingham?
No, it's Page County, I believe.
Buckingham is Buckingham, isn't it?
Page.
Buckingham is 44.
44.
I think Page County.
Okay.
Prince Edward.
Prince Edward, yeah, I'm sorry. Prince Edward.
And who is the highest?
90 is Powhatan.
Powhatan.
Now, if you on your sheet, if you look to the right, this is a little bit more difficult to see up here, but see these on these yellow blocks on the screen here?
Yeah.
That's the low one.
Uh-huh.
And if you go up farther, the green one is the high one.
Okay.
So every line has a high and a low, a yellow and a green box. That tells you who was the high and who was the low.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you see the reds on here, some of these stand out just because they're odd. If you look at the average for machinery and tools tax, the average is $666,000. We're only at $9,000. Now, I can tell you that the one of these counties skews it dramatically. The 5.9 million, I think that's Buchanan County. Yeah, Buchanan County is 5.9. Yeah, and so they have a kind of a special circumstance there. I would take that figure out and average the rest to really see where the average is. It's certainly not 666. But when you do that, it's still dramatically and significantly above what Fluvanna County is for machinery and tools tax.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not because our rates are so different, because our rates fall smack dab in the middle. I don't know what the difference is, but those are the things that we look at that we want to potentially identify and say maybe that's something we should look at and see, are we missing something, or do we have it set wrong, or whatever. When you go down farther on that same page, the BPO license is another one that I'm going to be targeting and recommending on there, some information as we go farther back. So either places we recommend to look at because we question, or because we recommend to look at them because they may be suitable for additional revenue sources for us, are highlighted on your sheet. Bank stock taxes. I don't know
I can spell bank stock taxes. And that's all I know about it. I mean, I can read the book and I can tell you what it says there, but I'm not sure exactly how it applies. And so, because we're so low compared to most other localities, it just is one that I want to be able to do some more investigation on to find out why. Why are we different than everybody else? Now, when you go to Cumberland, Cumberland's only 8,000. I'm not sure why they're... And then Goochland County is 3.6 million. Maybe Capital One, right? There's a lot of reasons, but when we're so far off the low end or the high end, or we're closer to one end or the other, I just want to understand the reasons why. So, restaurant food taxes. We don't have a meals tax, but that's one of the ones we'll talk about. If you go down to Mr. Jarl's doing some work on the explanations of what these ones down line 73, 74, 75, the green ones at the bottom, that's permits, privilege fees, fines and forfeitures, charges for services, so down in the 70s. There's several of them down there we've got highlighted because they look so odd compared to our peers that are in similar size, so we're going to look at those too. But remember, some of the reporting may be because it's broken up just slightly differently, or they may be including different things in those categories. So Mr. Dahl's pulling some information on what are included in all those. If this interest line is truly just interest, just on our money, then that's something we want to look at. The charge for services, we're $2.4 million charged for services, but I'm not sure exactly which sets are charged in that one. Largely, there's a Parks and Rec there, but there must be the permit fees. Or
no, it's not the permit fees. I need to go back and look.
Okay, permit fees are actually our first one. But Parks and Rec certainly doesn't bring in $2.4 million a year. If it did, we'd be expanding Parks and Rec. But if you look at the difference on the charges for services, one county is at $2 million, one county is at $14 million. And again, I want to understand the differences between those when there's such a distinct difference. And then when you go down the bottom, we have revenue recovery there. The initial information we pulled from around the area ranges go anywhere from $300,000 to $1.2 million in revenue recovery during the course of the year from different localities. But we haven't even pulled all of them yet. But if you look at all the blue ones, the blue counties are the counties directly surrounding us. The only county that's directly surrounding us that doesn't have revenue recovery is Buckingham. Every other county that is directly surrounding us, adjacent to us, is using revenue recovery and it's billing free of that services.
Cumberland's not using, right?
I'm sorry, Cumberland. Cumberland. I'm sorry. Yeah. I didn't mean Buckingham.
Buckingham is using it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You're right.
They're also using
it for the
We don't have a number.
No, some of the ones we have numbers for, some of the ones we don't. But we can look at some of these with some reasonable assurance on numbers when we just compare the number of calls and the volume of calls
that's
we have in our county versus others.
We look at population and when we're looking at
this. Yeah, the very top line is population, every single one.
Yeah, I mean, that's key.
Yeah, that's why. The blues, remember, are people that are close to us. They go from 10,000 to 33,000, but they're all our surrounding. The oranges are almost all very close to our population, from 23,000 to 28,000. That's why I didn't take anything that was outside of 30,000 except for Orange and Louisa. I believe we're the only two.
We're talking revenue recovery. We're only talking insurance recovery, correct?
That's not necessarily the case. It's a dramatically complicated issue for a couple of reasons. A, you have to bill for services. Okay? And you can't just forgive anyone because they don't have insurance. It doesn't mean you're going to collect from them. You have to, maybe people call it compassionate billing. And when you're billing for Medicare, people that have Medicare, versus billing for other people without insurance, with other types of insurance, you have to be very careful not to set a dual standard. There are just federal rules about that. But, in general, counties that have successfully put revenue recovery in place essentially end up collecting from people that have the ability to pay and insurers. But I wouldn't want to ever say that we don't bill people without insurance.
It's something we never put out to the public that if you can't pay, you don't pay.
I would never say that. I would tell them
that your ability to pay your ride in an ambulance is not in any shape or form ever contingent on your ability to pay, because the ambulance comes first. The talk about billing comes later. So I would always say that your ability to pay does not affect whether you get a ride in an ambulance. But it's a nuanced discussion that we have to do more work and more research on it. But all the counties around us, if you go to the websites and read the reviews and the history and how they did it and how it's a difficult, complicated process. Mm-hmm. But one that is reasonable and appropriate in today's world.
We've been talking about that for
a couple of years.
Since I got on board, there was things all around the year before that. But I'm not suggesting that this is an easy thing to do. I'm just suggesting that it's an appropriate thing to be talking about in 2014.
Do we get charged for mutual aid?
Do we get charged for mutual aid?
If somebody gives mutual aid.
Oh, absolutely. If Scottsville Rescue comes and picks up somebody in our county, they send a bill.
Right. One thing that...
If Louisa does send, they send a bill.
One thing I did when I was asked to look into this, because I looked at Albemarle's website, and Albemarle's website has Q&As.
Mm-hmm. Right,
and
so too.
And one of the things it says is, it's critical to understand, no one will ever be denied EMS treatment or transport based on ability to pay. And then it says, patients will be charged according to the type of service received and the distance they're transported. If you can't pay, you won't have to pay. All patients will be treated and transported regardless of ability to pay. This program will not change the ambulance service provided anybody in the county, regardless of insurance coverage or any other factor. Albemarle County will not deny service to those with unpaid balances. If you cannot pay, a hardship waiver form will be made available to you. And so it's done on the basis of you get a bill, and you say, I lost my job, I don't have insurance, I can't pay this. Then you fill out the waiver form, and there's a standard by which that's reviewed, and you may get all a part of it waived.
And it's not that you don't pay because you don't want to pay. It's based on your ability to pay. And there are federal laws about how you have to bill and how you can forgive bills. If you're a Medicare-accepting provider, then you have to be careful with those rate cases that you do for that. In this case, there may be some nuances that don't apply exactly the same way, but it's on your ability to pay, not on your willingness to pay. So, but I would agree 100% that no one would ever be denied an ambulance trip because they have an outstanding bill or because they say they don't have the funds to pay.
Let me say one thing, and you need to listen carefully to this because you may never hear it again. I think Albemarle has a good model for us to have on this resource recovery. So I think it's...
We don't have to
reinvent the wheel.
Oh, they do?
No, we don't send anybody a bill today from any county writer. There's so many nuances. Mrs. Wilkins has done a lot of research on this, and the Fire and Rescue Association has done research, and there's lots of citizens that have lots of strong opinions that have done research on it. There is no perfect, easy answer to this, except that I'm going to hope tonight that you will say, yes, staff, go forward with starting to do formal research on this and bring back proposals.
I thought we were doing that.
Well, we have never formally gotten direction from the board to do revenue recovery. We've just been informally researching it, and we've told the FRA, until the board gives us authority to go forward, then we will engage with everyone and set up a work group and get set to go. We've done all kinds of informal research already. So this sheet, I can refer back to this anytime tonight, but that sheet you've got in front of you shows the highs and lows for each line, the revenues, and there are still unanswered questions, because why is some county, at $5 million when everybody else is at $300,000? Well, coal country. I mean, different things like that. But there are still questions we want to answer off this sheet. But let's go on to talk about some of the things that... based on other revenue sources besides just real estate and personal property. So in January, you saw the same slide where it showed, different counties, just the ones immediately surrounding our area, how many people are collecting merchants' capital tax and business license fee or BPL tax.
Now, you have to be a little careful. You normally, if you're a county, you normally can't have a merchant's capital tax and a B-poll tax.
You can't statute prohibits.
Right. Yeah,
there's some nuances of how you do it. Now, you can have a business license fee, and that's a little separate from the B-poll tax itself, because the tax is based on a rate and on either in or gross revenue or things like that. But the business license fee that's part of the B-poll process is really a fee to be licensed, to operate your business.
What's the merchant's capital tax? What's the difference between that and B-poll?
I can read you the exact. B-poll is based on revenue that comes into the business.
Okay.
Merchant's cap is based on the value of the property.
Oh, okay.
So on these slides, as you see them up in the corner, the ones we think that have the most merit, that there might be a need to be a change to, we might want to look at hardcore seriously including are the ones that have this change under. There are a number that you'll see that we don't make the recommendation. On here, the planning fees and proffers. Now, the planning fees, if you just take one example, we charge $750 for a rezoning. We'll just go to our immediate neighbor to the north, they charge $1,000 for rezoning. Now, I'm not suggesting we want to be higher than anybody. I'm just suggesting that there might be some reason why, well, the SUPs are 500, we're at 800. Maybe we want to be a little bit more comparable. Maybe on site plan reviews, maybe we want to reduce it.
Yeah, what year did we change this within the 6 years I've been on the board? When was that? When did we change it? When Darren Coffey was here, we made a change. Do you remember when that was?
I don't know, and I didn't check to find out when the last time we changed, but it would have been before 2012.
One thing about this, when you're talking about fees for this kind of land use review, that needs to be based on cost recovery. So, and that's the last time we did it. It was planning department did a study of how much time it took for this analysis. Mm-hmm. And if you notice, one of these things that we've done from time to time, especially with cell towers, is those have some specialized review. Mm-hmm. So we've had to have consultants come in and talk about that.
Yeah.
In that case, they pay the consultant.
Sure.
So, but if you come in and say that all subdivisions are going to pay $1,000 for review, that's going to be very difficult to defend, because in some subdivisions it may be $5,000, in some it may be $150, two lots, and it takes 20 minutes to review.
Right, and this $1,000 plus $10 an acre that Louisa has may be a better way to look at it based on size, too. But if you look at water starts, we don't list ours. Ours is our $4,000, I believe, for a wireless tower. But you can see they range from $4,500, $2,500, $1,500. So we're a little bit all over the map. But this is not necessarily an area of significant revenue. I mean, hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Right.
But what we want is reasonable and fair rates that try to cover our costs, but don't look outrageous compared to our neighbors either. And if we're going to be looking towards building and expanding and growing in our growth areas, we want to be as reasonable as possible. Now, this is on site plan reviews and rezonings and things like that. The proffer fees, you'll be getting a presentation back from through the planning commission that has recommended proffer guidance that will be provided back to the Board of Supervisors. Residential building permits, we're pretty much in the middle there, but if you look above us, and who's above us? Orange, Goochlin, Louisa. Now Orange is a little lower, but Louisa. But we have separate fees for some of these subsystems for electrical, plumbing, and mechanical, whereas Louisa does not. It's wrapped into their major fee. So we're not, there's not a lot of wiggle room there. Even if you doubled it, you'd be up by Powhatan, but we're not really competing most of the time with Powhatan for building a home or anything. So, again, another one you might potentially look at, but have the planning department do a review of those if you want to consider those. I just don't think there's much revenue there for it. Commercial building permit fees, we're already on the higher end. I'd be interested more in keeping those lower rather than higher. We're above the average
you know, really pretty much across the board, but not too many higher than us. Now, Louisa, I'm not sure what the exact rates would be because it's based on total building costs, but we'd have to actually pull a specific building and check it and then apply our rates to it, but they're pretty high in there. Again, in all these areas, we're still not talking about particularly big dollars. Erosion and sediment control fees, now there'll be a whole series of much higher fees from the state for stormwater regulations, but on regular erosion sediment control fees, we're right in the middle of the pack now. Again, really pretty much the same right here. On machinery and tools, on elderly and disabled exemptions, on our vehicle taxes, and then even on land use, although the board doesn't set land use rates, that's set by the Commission of Revenue, the board can only put it in place or not have it in place. But in these cases, the Commission of Revenue just changed the land use numbers last year, and the other ones on here were pretty much in line with others. And again, all these are listed on your big spreadsheet too, so you can see a comparison to about 20 counties there. Parks and Rec rental and fees and usage fees. We just readjusted all that last year and looked hard at the schedule for it, so I wouldn't necessarily recommend a change. Plus, you're talking about very small dollars out of Parks and Rec anyway. I would love to see Parks and Rec bring in a lot more dollars, but that will take time to revise how we do business and get Pleasant Grove really cranking with a lot more events there. Revenue recovery, the one that's going to be a hot button issue. When you look at revenue recovery, from a volunteer's perspective, why are you charging for something I do for free? I clearly understand that rationale, and I guess the automatic response from me would be, because if we charge for those services that we legitimately have a reasonable, legal, and typical and usual opportunity to charge for, it helps us support the function you're doing. Equipment, supplies, gear, training, recertifications, there's a whole variety of things. Now, I'm not suggesting out loud here that let's assume we got $500,000 a year in revenue recovery. I'm not suggesting that every penny of that is exactly going 100% to ambulance services. Because I'm not sure we can necessarily afford that. I'm not sure we can plow $500,000 into ambulance services, unless you use it for contract services or new equipment or things like that. I am suggesting maybe a different way of funding. I think Ms. Wilkins found an example from, was it Powhatan? That one you said today?
Yes.
From Powhatan. Well, actually, the not the ordinance, but the language that the resolution that was adopted by the board lays out what the funds are going to be used for. I would suggest that we have some clarity if you go to revenue recovery, and staff will be making specific recommendations after we work with the Fire and Rescue Association and the various agencies. But I'm not on the front side suggesting that every nickel goes directly back to EMS. I just don't know yet. I'd have a hard time fitting $500,000 back into EMS unless it's supplanting something we're already doing, because we don't even pay $500,000 now for EMS services. We have about 60,000 for the three squads and about 30,000, I think, for Lake Monticello, and we have 300,000, a little under 300,000 for the ambulance. We're not even 500,000 yet, I mean for the paid crew. Now, add equipment on top of that and replacement equipment, it'll get there, but we don't even own those buildings. So, I'm not sure necessarily how the funds are applied, because there's many creative ways to do that. What I'm suggesting is that if we go towards revenue recovery, it needs to be a fairly broad discussion with lots of voices in it, and come down with a reasonable plan, and there are many reasonable plans from counties all around the Commonwealth of Virginia on how they implemented revenue recovery to see what would work best for Fluvanna County. But I am certainly going to suggest that it's one we push hard on. Anyway, Louisa, as an example, Louisa's program collects about $1 million a year. They do about twice the calls we do. So in a ballpark, we're saying $400,000 to $600,000 in a full year of revenue recovery. That's with a contractor that does the billing and does the collections and things like that. The work group, the Fluvanna Leadership Development Class, the work group that did worked on this project as well, put together a chart that shows different types of revenue sources.
And we've talked about most of these, although we haven't really talked about special service districts. Mr. Penn did us a favor by talking about that a little bit earlier. And tank taxing, finance that we can look at further. We've talked a little bit about proffers. But, you know, I'm not sure that there's any good way to take money out of somebody's pocket unless you have a really good story on what that money is going to be used for and why is it a benefit to that citizen. In this case, revenue recovery, we can certainly, I think, make a really good case for it. I think you can certainly make a good case for money in taxes for police and education and fire and rescue and emergency services. But people value parks and recreation and open spaces and clean rivers and roads that work, roads that are easy to drive. So while some of these say poor, good, and fair, none of them are great if you're just adding to the stack. But in our case, maybe we need to be changing our stack so that we have a more fair tax base. In some cases, maybe adding to it. But maybe we ought to look at the kinds of taxes we have in relationship to all of our peers across the Commonwealth and see if there's a better way for us to rack and stack the numbers we have so we can mitigate potential future increases on just real estate or personal property. And so, you know, this is just a quick broad brush, but the things staff would recommend would be to formally go ahead with a financial analysis and coming back with a plan to implement a business license fee. I've actually talked to business people in the county now and asked them about business license fees, and everyone I talked to said, well, my gosh, that'd be great because it'd get those guys out that have this the fly-by-night things, and we need to get people to actually do that and get them on the rolls. And I said, what if it were $35, $50, $75 a year fee is the figures I use. And so I'm not suggesting that's a scientific poll in any case. I'm just suggesting that it would be great to know where businesses are, which ones they are, and have an annual fee of $25, $50, $75 a fee, like many other counties do, for them to be licensed in our county.
Do you think the Chamber of Commerce would come out and support? Is that a place to...
Mr. Olmert could probably speak to that.
About,
more,
so.
I'd be reluctant to ask that question at this point. I'll tell you why.
Uh-huh.
The maximum fee we can charge is $50.
Mm-hmm.
The tax is a different issue, but the fee is limited to $50 per hour in the population bracket.
Okay.
The problem with it is that you need to adopt the BPOL tax ordinance. Now, you don't have to, in my opinion, you don't have to assess the taxes. You can assess only the fee, but you have to have the whole thing set up there.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as you start talking about BPOL taxes,
mm-hmm.
if you come in and say you want a license fee of $50, people are probably going to say what Steve said, they said, and that is, it's a good idea, it keeps the scoff laws out and stuff like that. But as soon as you say we're going to adopt a BPOL ordinance, you're going to get lots of pushback.
Right.
And we're talking about $17,000 to $20,000 for a business license at $50. So we're not talking any kind of money.
It's not huge dollars. This is more of a tracking tool.
It's a can of worms you're opening for $17,600.
You see this somewhat thick file here?
Right.
This is the history of BPOL taxes in Savannah County. Yep. We've done this three times.
Nelson's
at $32,000 and they have a $30 license fee but no tax. Powhatan has a $50 fee and no tax, and they did $99,005. Green has it. Also has a tax.
I mean, in other words, you're
they have a business license fee. Plus,
what you brought up is that there's a structure that you have to put in place first.
Right.
Yeah, and then of course, what you're bringing up is
let me try
components, but it was an advantage.
Let me say one thing about BPOL tax, and this is a peculiar thing, but BPOL taxes are assessed by the, if you will, the home locality, but to the extent that the revenue is generated in another locality and payable to that county, they get credit against the home tax. So, in other words, if you got somebody that's headquartered in the city of Richmond, and they pay, you know, $100,000 they have revenue that would make $100,000, but they do $20,000 worth of work in Fluvanna, and Fluvanna doesn't have a B poll tax, then that would go to Fluvanna, goes to the city of Richmond.
That's correct.
And I can tell you that I'm not kidding. When VDOT built the new Bremo Bridge, I got a call from Chesterfield County thanking the county because we didn't have a B poll tax because the contract was headquartered in Chesterfield.
It's the same thing when the school was built, and the same thing when this bridge. I brought this up a month ago.
Right.
How much money we left on the table.
Well, it's the other way around, too, and that is, if we had a B poll tax, and believe me, I've done this often enough, I'm not really interested in doing it again unless we really need to. But my point is, if we have a B poll tax, and we have a contractor that's headquartered here, and he does work in a county that doesn't have a tax, we get revenue from that.
But they're fewer and far between.
But there probably are some, or there at least there could be some.
Okay.
Yeah, it's.
All right. So anyway, not an easy thing to do necessarily, but
it's likely to be controversial politically. That's what I wanted to tell you.
Indeed, and I don't know, maybe the question is if you adopt the B-poll ordinance for our county, and you only assess a business license fee, does that preclude then the tax revenue going to someplace else? Because we only have the
I don't
fee?
Think so.
Okay.
Can
you possibly do one where you do a limit when you have a big project like that?
You can set limits.
Well, you can, but there are some criteria for that. And the statute's very involved, and I can't quote you exactly what it says. There are exemptions, and you are allowed to do ranges. But the ranges are... The way the statute is set up, there's a whole statute that says if you adopt this tax... These are the mandatory provisions you must have. And I go through the list. I got the statute here to read it to you, but I don't remember what they are.
I sat down with our county administrator one and a half county administrators ago. And there's a book that's thick, kind of, for State of Virginia B-poll taxes. And we spent like 3 days going through the thing. And it's a nightmare. But, and when you brought up the chamber being in favor, the state chamber yearly fights to have people...
There have been measures in the General Assembly...
As far as state goes.
There have been measures in the General Assembly in the last few years to disable people altogether. People is an extremely regressive tax because it's a tax on gross revenues.
Right.
And so, if you got something like a grocery business, you got a very narrow profit margin. On the other hand, if you got some other kind of business that has a big profit margin, it hits the grocery business much harder because it's based on gross revenue.
Real estate's a no.
But that's part of the banning process.
Sorry, what?
That's part of the banning process. Fairfax County, for example, the assessment, say, food services business is very different.
That's true, and there are criteria for that.
Not to take away from the fact that it's regressive, but by banning it, you can put in place a way to try to generally even out the regressive nature of the tax to some degree.
That's true. That's true, but any kind of gross revenue tax is always going to be regressive.
Like I said, the support is... the chamber can't support it because the state chamber fights it every year, and it is regressive. And what happens is you start drawing in this extra income, and the danger is that it's extra money, not taking it off the backs of 9,100 homes. It's all of a sudden extra money.
If this were big enough, I would recommend this one be used to lower the personal property tax rate, but it's probably not going to be big enough to lower a nickel on the personal property tax rate because nickel's $85,000.
No, down the road. So. No, just a license fee is, like I just said, it's not going to go over $20,000. And you're opening a can of worms for $20,000 to count business.
Yeah, maybe that or thereabouts, but anyway.
It's not going to go over. I'm within $10,000. And is that worth the pain that you go through of opening the door to people?
I don't think it is.
Well, but it's also a tool for firstly to be able to measure its economic growth, is to be able to measure the kind of employers it has in the area.
Well, supposedly we have
both. I'm in Charlottesville. I pay $5,000 in people taxes. So I know about people.
I know all about it.
Yeah.
I didn't know this was bad.
I had to pay a license fee to close the business. So, you know, vehicle taxes is...
To Susanna County?
I
don't remember collecting that.
I've opened and closed a few more businesses.
You can hold the people out here. You can make people out here.
The business...
I tried to fail.
The business also benefits from being in a county, right?
Right.
Okay, the business is a citizen of the county. And therefore also has a responsibility to share and work.
You're not going to get an
argument.
It's perfectly understandable that business people don't want to pay tax, and that the part of the Chamber of Commerce and things like that would be to say, hey, you know, we don't want to do this, you're going to start up a business. But it's also equally fair to say, you know, you are, just as for example, recognize that, you know, there is a cost, and there's
but I want water.
That have to contribute, and so, you know, businesses recognize that as well too.
I was, if you didn't talk to me a year and a half ago, I was totally against it. But when what was it, 2011 or whatever it was, we had the chamber president stand up and said, "Spend more money," and on schools, for instance. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was. The president stood there and said, raise the taxes. Well, we weren't raising the taxes on businesses, we were raising it on Austin. So that's when my mind changed. So because it's spreading it spreads it out. If a business leader is going to stand up and say, tax people more, well, that's opening the door in my own mind to saying, well, that opened the door as far as my change my mind on people goes. I mean, fair is fair. And that's what, now I agree.
Well, so the county, we all know the county is in a difficult position right now because, you know, if you look at this chart here and you know, credit to the staff for all their hard work, we don't have that many levers that we're
You able. Can't take extra, you can't find new revenue sources and then all of a sudden spend more revenue.
I understand that, but that's our responsibility here, right? I mean, we have two levers, right? What we bring in and what we take out, right? And so controlling and expecting efficiencies out of the people that are using our money, that's part of our responsibility.
And something
that's part of our responsibility, for example, that when we build infrastructure, that we plan for its depreciation. Right. Mm-hmm. So therefore, we're not surprised. Right. It's also part of our responsibility to make sure that our revenue sources are even and planned for the future, and not just what is the most politically expedient, good feeling tax of the day.
You're right, but unfortunately, as far as a PR standpoint goes, you're in a bad spot to raise taxes 22%, but then you're going to raise new revenue sources.
But eat it up.
Asking people to believe that you're not going to go on a spending spree with new revenue.
Well, some people would call that blowing the lid off the county, I think.
That's just the way it is. I mean, if I have Mr. O'Brien Forte and I can spend the extra revenue on something that's other than saving it from, you know, 9,100 households that pay the high taxes. Then I jump on board, and I always take your word for it.
So staff recommendations include doing a formal analysis and investigate. We'll tell you how much we think we collect.
Right.
VPOL license fee. Same with EMS revenue recovery. But I'd like to put really a group together with the FRA, with the Fire and Rescue Association, and get key personnel involved, because that's going to be an interesting and important and a controversial discussion. I think all the counties that have gone that way, when they've been very inclusive and really done good communications on it, it has gone better than expected, but it can be a controversial issue anyway.
And one last point about the people tax too, just for us to keep in mind, is if we get the growth that we expect to see and we hope to see in Zion's Crossroads, right? That issue will only become more difficult for us. You know, if you have 500 businesses in Fluvanna right now arguing against it, you'll have 2,000 maybe, or you know, 1,500.
But if you've got it established,
you should have a plan.
Yeah.
And if it's established, it's a gift.
Yeah. And the other thing is, if you go back to, I think, Steve, you put, I think you put the 1997 research that the board did on revenue thing.
It's on your iPad.
It's on the iPad. If you go back and read, that was a very well put together document. And it was, and they thought they had it passed. And I think they ended up losing the vote on it. And in that report was just kind of put on the shelf.
Sure.
But that was some good research. And that was 1997.
We're a two-trick pony county.
Yeah.
Right. Real estate, personal property, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not suggesting we should be different. I'm suggesting there are ways we could be different if we wanted to. Mm-hmm. And we could look at them differently. You could potentially spread it out. Now, I'm reticent to take money from anybody unless there's a really good plan for it, especially when it's an offset.
Yes.
But in this case, we might be able to, you might be able to, long-term, moderate increases in the big taxes, the real estate and personal property, by leveling off the other types of things that we could levy. But anyway.
Right. And the last thing that you put on that, it would certainly, you know, consider using it for. I think that just gives the community a good feeling about it.
Well, it gives them a good feeling if you actually follow through on it.
Yeah, right. But I think, you know, if we can follow through on something like
that. That was my whole point.
Yes, it kind of makes people.
So, and Mr. Wives talked about this during his campaign, and even since then, about the personal property tax, and I think Mr. Sheridan did too. I mean, we're at a much higher rate than what Louisa County is directly to our north, and maybe we ought to be looking at trying to rescind a little bit of that, but maybe some of these other revenue sources can allow us to do that.
Sure.
That would not only affect homeowners, but businesses. Now, you could also, I think you can have a business personal property and a regular personal property, or is it?
There's 9 bands, I think, according to the Commissioner of Revenue, of different categories.
Yeah, there are, because there are other personal property things that are taxable in a business that are not taxable personally.
And while it's not huge dollars, I mean, not like, you know, $10-20 million, it is $85,000 per nickel.
Right.
So it's not like it's $85,000 a penny, or $85,000 for 50 cents change. I mean, trying to decrease it down to $4 from $4.15 now. That's $250,000.
I mean, that got raised, I think, 3 years ago.
Yeah.
No, it was 2009-10.
Yeah. It was an election year. And what happened was, and I was right where you were sitting right now, they raised that rate, the personal property tax, so they didn't have to raise.
But it's a hard one to buy back on, as it's
the real estate.
Was?
Yeah, sure.
I was on the board too.
Mr. Gooch was still on the board, I think.
Yes, yes,
he was.
Right.
And that was to avoid raising the real estate tax. And so at the same time, that license fee of $33, whatever it is, got instituted at $10 a year fee, some oddball fee.
So those top two are the two that I would most strongly recommend looking at very hard and coming back with a plan for implementation. Not that you're necessarily going to adopt it, but I think you need to unleash staff to really go forward on these top two. That's my recommendation. Third, I think we ought to at least take a look at meals tax. I know that requires a referendum, and it's from, you know, 2 to 4, or 1 to 4%. I guess you can do 1%. I'm not sure. You can go up to 4%.
Right.
But it's failed some places. It's got passed some places. I think Louisa tried 3 times before the 3rd time it finally passed. And it's not like we have a mecca of restaurants, you know, where it's the restaurant mecca. But we have the potential for that.
Right.
And if you look at the revenues from meals tax and other like-sized jurisdictions, it may be something to look at as well. Again, my view would be, if you enact some of these other things, you can help moderate the bigger taxes, the real estate taxes, but that's
meals tax. You go to Charlottesville, you're paying it, and you don't.
Well, around here, almost everybody.
And you don't even. Yeah. You don't.
And
even
you charge everybody at 4%.
Thanks,
but I found interesting.
The last time in Charlottesville, on their meals tax, I heard on the radio, they got over $300,000 in over-projected money on the meals tax. So they have quite a potful there.
The important thing is to be very conservative on that. We want to be very conservative on the meals tax.
Frankly,
on all these, I would almost be willing to recommend not putting any revenue in the first year they're implemented.
Right.
Because, you know, if you're talking about 20, 30, 50, you just don't know. Revenue recovery, we could have a pretty reasonable idea of what it would be because of insurance billings, but I on the rest of them, I just don't know.
Custer colors.
Whatever you can call it,
One thing about Mr. Ellenbrook's distinction he drew with Fesney is the difference between BPOL and revenue recovery, because revenue recovery is a user fee.
Right.
And that's, we have a problem with the user fee.
So planning fees, I didn't realize that it required as much milk as what Mr. Payne had said, but I think that's something, we ought to be looking at. Now, having said that, the planning department is really busy. Mm-hmm. And the planning commission is really busy because it's a regular year plus it's comp plan year. So I'm not sure we necessarily want to take this on this year, but I would put it on their work plan for next year.
There is the other thing. The individual review load is very light. There aren't many subdivisions and site plans and rezones.
So we're not talking much money yet.
Not now. But in years past, it would have been a large figure, and it's likely to be in the future. But if you know, if it took a year for you to get this studied out, you really wouldn't be losing much because there aren't that many to be done.
So I would think that sometime before the budget season is done next year, before you adopt a budget, you'd want to see a package back on these kinds of rates, on potentially identifying any changes to rates that the staff would recommend, because then we can also cost out what that would be means in terms of revenue for that following year. Again, not that we necessarily want to count too much of it, but at least you'd know. So I would propose that you don't really look at this hard, but start the investigation now, but as time permits through the rest of this year and into the winter and early spring, looking at that one. The fourth item down here is I really want the planning department to finalize and finish up on their proffer guidance to get it to the board, so we've got formal proffer guidance.
Right.
Again, it's not proffer requirements, it's proffer guidance. And then some of those things that are on that big chart that you've got that are marked in red, they're just odd. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with them. I just don't understand why they are that way. And I'm sure somebody smarter than me or more experienced than me, like every time Mr. Payne tells us something, I learn something new every night. I'll talk to the commissioner, I'll talk to the treasurer. He sounds authoritative. But anyway, I think we need to investigate those further, and so I'll be doing that. And then, especially, I would give special consideration to, if you're going to enact any new fees, taxes, change in revenue streams, you might want to consider focusing on things you've all talked about before, like the personal property tax, and maybe having a different band, or maybe adjusting it somewhat. But now probably wouldn't be the best time to put in great big brand new fees and costs and taxes if you're promoting development. You'd want to be, at least be reasonable with your honest, because our real estate tax rate is pretty high.
Okay.
So now there's, we can go a lot deeper. The group from FLDP had some nuances on this that they looked at, but I don't think the time now is to look at TIFs or special taxing districts or things like that in this context. We will, as we start working on district service districts for potentially for water and sewer, but you can only take on so many bites at one time is too full.
Is the leadership group that gave that presentation, is their presentation somewhere?
I've got it right here, yes.
That we can,
send it
to us?
Sure.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But we need to look at that. I mean, I was there the night they presented it.
It's 65 slides, the full 64, 65 slides. You've seen most of it before, other than some of the detailed charts that I pulled, some of the things I'll put in here.
Right.
So you've got it, but I'll send it to you off to all of you, too.
And it's on the FLDP website.
It is?
On the FLDP website.
It is.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, all the projects
are
loaded up out there too.
Right. Okay. Now, we've had discussions. Do we have any more discussion on that? So we kind of know where we're going in that direction. Anybody?
I'm kind of thinking that you agree with this
yes.
plan.
Yes, we agree with
the plan. And we're going to move forward
with that plan. That was on the screen. All of us agree with this. Nod in the heads, nod here, nod there. Double nod. What you think? Done?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so everybody's on board with that. And
the members of the FLDP work group that worked on this project also
appreciate
are here tonight.
It. Thank
in case
you.
They have any,
thank
in case
you.
Any questions
Carlson's
for them.
Carlson's here. Who else? Yes,
Mr.
thank
Shane,
you
Mr.
so
Will.
Much. Thank you all for coming.
Did
everything. Yeah.
We are all right.
They had good stuff that we stole with Route Light Cutting.
That's great. Yeah. Okay. Now, the next one is about our Strategic Initiatives Action Plan update.
Yes, ma'am. So, this is really the first time we've kind of done the kind of a formal brief at night. What I would suggest is that every month or every other month when you do a work session, this will be part of your topics.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have not posted this specific version that's in front of you, the one with the reds and the greens and the yellows on the website yet, and with the basic chart is out there, but not all the updates. This is as kind of as much of an update as I can do by myself or with a little bit of staff help before we actually start engaging you and discussing this. Now, secondary on your stack of papers, there's this four-page little booklet. Mr. Popowitz and Mr. Wilkins put this together to start meeting the mail on some of the taskers that are on here. This is one to be able to use around our county to explain why we would invest in infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
So please take a look at that.
Nice.
Chop on it. Make comments, scribble on it, give us any feedback you have. We're going to give it to a bunch of other folks too, because we really want this to be kind of a document you can hand to anybody, and they can take it home and not read it and scan through. They can go to little different sections in here and get some facts and mid notes, but it doesn't have to take 4 days to explain it. And it's written in pretty common language and not technical engineering terms.
Anytime we highlight
Wise
County is going to do
something,
it only strengthens.
So, Cheryl Wilkins and Bobby Popovich are ones that have worked on this real hard, and
good job.
The feedback will be really important. But what we would expect is then this will be printed on kind of that shiny paper, just like this.
Mm-hmm.
So, meetings like this, we can have some here. When I go do a talk, or a criminal goes to talk, take some of his hand
right.
out. And you've got a town hall meeting, hand some out.
We have a copy of
No, not the fancy things. Nice. We print these in-house, but we need to take it to get it printed on this.
I just want to point out that in the budget, there's $10,000
for marketing, and that's where the dollars would come back. Bobby, how much was it for your book?
$700?
Have you seen his books? The bound books, you know, the hard, shiny paper. He got loads of those printed. That was only $700.
Wow.
And that's for every business we're doing engagement with and things like that.
Right.
So.
And even in
This print doesn't do this kind of very good, though. We do lots of new stuff.
Right. Can I, to go to this page, did you finish? I'm sorry.
Let me tell you what I've got here. So this chart can be modified 50 ways to Sunday, but it's a starting point for you on what you agreed to as far as tasks. You wanted to know maybe a champion for the board. I kind of filled in some names as proposals. Anything that staff has responsibility for, and then anything we've done on it so far. If it's a red, it hasn't started. If it's a yellow, it's underway. If it's a green, it's done.
Okay.
So this would be something you'd see on a regular basis.
All right.
Yes, ma'am.
I want to. Yeah, Ben.
No, but I'll stop just for your benefit.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm supposed to just look at you.
That works.
It works.
Just give him the evil eye.
Right. Give him the mother eye.
Just give him the evil eye.
The champion.
Yeah.
I would like for us to talk about what do we mean by you being, it came from me. No, they can't then. I didn't assign people.
No, I put names that are based on things you've all talked about or been interested in. Or a part of, like Mr. O'Brien, he's on the planning commission, so I put him on a couple of those.
That doesn't mean that you are in charge or you're going to be the boss or anything like that.
She gets paid more to champion less.
But what you need to be there is so you're just interested in it. Yeah.
I could be home by 9 o'clock if I wanted to be. But
okay. All right. So, great. Is that all with this? We're finished with this, right?
We're just getting started. No, you've got a whole lot of work to do on this. This is the.
I know we have a lot to work to do. Yeah, but I mean.
This is why I want more work. This is why I hate these.
Okay, the champions in section one.
All right.
Do those champions make sense based on what you've asked about?
Just the number.
Okay. In section one, Mr. O'Brien, 1A.
Yes.
1B. You okay with those?
Yes.
All right. 1C, Mr. Sheridan, and that's
Brad.
Tourist development.
That's okay.
Right?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh.
Yeah, I already said that.
And Mr. O'Brien, develop infrastructure plans for businesses.
Now, the only thing is you could put two supervisors' names there, too, because I had a lot on yours, but it was partly because you had focused on those, but you're also on the pilot commission.
Yes,
okay.
I'll take all that if anybody wants to.
All right.
So Mrs. Booker's already
doing the
code of ethics.
Chairman's message, I've done one, and right. I need to do... I haven't gotten a... month. I guess next month.
We can probably do a July 1st one.
Okay.
Because you did March, so.
Right. All right. And
that way you'll be at least
Sheridan Services in Pearl, Dyer County, baseline performance. Annual county report, Mr. Sheridan.
Let me back up.
All right.
2C. Mm-hmm. That has nothing to do with emergency services.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It is what we do as a business and what are our core services. Mrs. Wilkins is just happens to be the staff person I'm going to put on that.
Right.
Okay. She doesn't know all the shit. This is core services written all at large. Why do we have a finance department and what are their core services? Why do we have a commissioner of revenue? What are the core services? And then, because those things are going to be part of the annual report that goes with the CAFR.
Mm-hmm.
Because it'll be like kind of a people's report. They call them PAFRs in lots of places. People's annual financial report.
Mm-hmm.
But this won't necessarily be financial. It'll be more based on what we've done as a community over the year, what we've accomplished. You'll see some samples of those coming up. But so it will include emergency services, but not just emergency services. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then 2D. Now, what did you say the yellow stood for?
It's a deer.
Underway.
In progress.
In progress.
Right.
Okay.
I'll move that.
So that's the one I just talked about, this annual report. And so I'm already starting to build that. I've already pulled samples from different areas. Staff has pulled things. But as that goes forward, you'll see drafts of those through the year. But it'll be something that'll go out with the CAFR when the Consolidated Annual Financial Report is published to you and to the community. It will also have a kind of a community, an annual community update, an annual county update.
Okay. All right, then on the other side, number 3, strengthen community partnership. Mr. O'Brien, you're with Sponsor County Future Forum, getting the community together.
And that's really largely part of the comp plan review process that'll be ongoing through the year, so he'll be included in both 3A
and B. He's on the planning commission, so that's
right.
He'll be up to date on everything on that. And Booker is on 3C, and this is with the public and the media.
So this is a fact sheet.
Yeah.
Okay, this is a more complicated fact sheet, a longer one. I'm really talking about one-page white papers.
Yes.
But we want somebody to kind of champion when there's a story or a message or a good story or a bad story or something going on. If it requires community knowledge, we want to be able to put together a story and have somebody else chop it and vet it. So.
And they really suggest that if you're going to talk to the media that you need to have points written down.
Yeah,
I do much better just talking.
Not about the county like being lost out at sea like airlines are.
And if you know, and 9 times out of 10, you know what they're going to ask you, you know, so you have to really put that together.
It's the one time out of ten when you're not prepared for what they're going to ask you that you shoot yourself in the foot. So.
I know it. I'm always afraid of what did I, and if all of, I think about my grandma, did I say, he is, you is?
You is
You
need to build up a really good relationship with yourself and reporter to make you sound intelligent.
Look, Bob said the best thing I need to do is leave the media to him. That's what I'm afraid of.
Let me put it this way. It does give the community more to talk about.
Yes.
Let's talk about it.
For 3D.
All right, 3D. Mr. O'Brien.
I just want 3 in case we
don't want to take anything away from
you are all long established.
So let's put Sharon.
Long established.
There's a difference.
We're meeting Friday. It's
long established and old.
And that's not a time when we're.
You're meeting
Friday at 10 a.m.
Who is?
What? With a group on doing some of this marketing stuff in Market for Vanna.
You gotta meet me.
I see what you're saying. I can't do that.
Well, we can still be on the link because. But we can still be on the link for anything that's chopped because you can still review it and
get confused. Okay. Okay. Next. And then the last one, Fund the Future. Mr. Weaver, Fiscal Policy.
Yes.
And
easy for me.
You have some.
So note on that first one though.
Pardon?
There are a lot of there are a lot of nuances with our financial policy. Well, first of all, they're kind of spread all over. You've got this one here, and you've got this one here, and this one here. I would like to have a consolidated, comprehensive county financial policy that includes a section for this and this and this.
Yes.
So we're in the process of kind of looking at all those things and mushing it back together. But that's when we start putting it together to bring back to the board for a proposal. I want to sit down with a board member who has history, that knows stuff, that can say, okay, well, here's why we went this way, or here's why we went this, or here's why we did that. Because I want a cleaner, clearer, easier to understand financial policy for our county that you don't have to go to 7 documents to find. We can find it one place.
It's been talked about in the past, vaguely. Same way with the state, they had a 2-year plan, basically. Mm-hmm. We certainly need something here on the board.
I think so. That's financial policy is one thing, but also how we do our budgeting is another that's related to that.
Yeah.
Too. Right.
Now,
so.
Mr.
That will require some work.
Sure. Mr. Nichols, can you give us a scenario of how you envision one of the champions working with one of these indicators?
So, as an example, we would get some things like this together, and then we would try to set up a meeting with one of the board members the hour before a board meeting.
Okay.
So, you don't have to we can always do it anytime you want, but especially for those at work, we try to do it before maybe the 7 o'clock board meeting. We could set up a meeting at 6 where we've got 3 or 4 staff sitting on. We also are going to do some citizen engagement meetings, and we would expect you and hope that you would be there for those.
Yeah.
It really depends on the nuance of some of these. This number 2D is largely a staff project, but
I need a supervisor to review it, go through it, ask questions about it, and say, wait a second, how about this thing, or how about that thing?
Okay.
So some of these were really just staff work. We need somebody to vet.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are going to be sit down and collaborate and decide how we're going to do it, like right. Some of the financial policies.
Sure. Okay. That's great. So we'll be really be involved in ownership in these initiatives. Any questions, anything else that we want to discuss about that before we go into closed session? Yes.
This is something different. I just had a question. I don't know if it's the right time. I'll ask. If not, you tell me later.
Here's some questions. You could ask anything.
E911. Are we still trying to bid that out, or is that a no deal?
Wait a week.
Okay. That's why I asked.
Mm-hmm.
I actually have an update for you, too.
Okay. Anything else we need to talk about before we go into close?
So please, we really are looking for comments to this.
Yeah.
Typos, spelling errors, nuances. We tried not to make it to anything specific without saying, you know, we're going to do this exact thing. it's really the overarching thing, but okay. They did a good job putting this together. We really want your feedback so then we can publish it.
All right. All right, Mr.
If we don't get any feedback by close of business Friday, we're going to print it.
Okay, Friday. Okay. Feedback by Friday.
Could you get a picture of me catching a bass?
I would like to. That's my if I get something by Monday, we're not going to print it anytime before next week.
Okay.
I just like your feedback now through the weekend.
Send a chance to read through it.
It's for me.
Okay. All right, Mr. Walker? Yes.
We'd be awesome.
Madam Chairman, I move that the Louisiana County Board of Supervisors enter into a closed meeting pursuant to provisions of Section 2.2-3711. 8.1, Section 2.2-3711, 8.3, Section 2.2-3711, 8.5, Section 2.2-3711, 8.3, the Code of Virginia, 1950, as amended for the purposes of discussing personnel, real estate, prospective industry, and investments of funds.
And
you can memorize this if you want to.
And legal matters.
You don't have that on here.
So, I added it late. She probably didn't know.
Okay. What code is that? Is that a different code? Or you just like... Okay. Our legal matters.
Yeah.
All right.
Whatever.
That is the motion. Do I have a second?
Oh, yes, ma'am.
All right. So Mr. Weaver has made the motion for closed session, and Mr. Sheridan seconded. So I guess we're all in favor.
That's pretty
solid.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. All right.
That's a big word. What's your
number? Big word.
I'll teach you to go this way.
That could be me.
Madam Chairman, I move the place meeting to adjourn, and if you run the County Board of Supervisors, open door open session, do it resolve to the best of my knowledge on public business matters lawfully exempted from open meeting requirements under Section 2.2-3711-8 of the Code of Virginia, 1950 as amended, and only such public business matters as were identified in the motion at which the closed meeting is convened, were heard, discussed, or considered in the meeting, Tony.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
And second, recording vote needed.
Okay. It's an aye for second.
All right.
Aye.
Aye.
And aye for the chair. I need a motion for adjournment.
Somebody.
Second.
All right.
It has been moved by Mr. Weaver, second by Mr. Sheridan. We adjourn. All in favor?
Yeah.
Any opposed? All right. We're adjourned.
Don't forget all your stuff.